Hello and welcome to WGTC Radio, the official podcast of entertainment website We Got This Covered. I'm Jonathan Lack.
And I'm Sean Chapman.
And we're here to talk about Spider-Man.
Spider-Man.
Yes. We're releasing this podcast on Wednesday, June 27th, and a week from now, the brand new movie, The Amazing Spider-Man, starring
Andrew. The Amazing Spider-Man!
Will be out in theaters, and I'm sure many of you will have seen it. So before the new movie comes out, we wanted to go back and look at the old movies, the original trilogy, if you will, by Sam Raimi, starring Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst, and maybe talk about whatever other sort of Spider-Man-related things we wanted to do. So that's what we're going to be doing this episode, reminiscing on some of our favorite nostalgic films, I think.
Yeah, so, definitely.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. And we have a special guest star with us today. He is also a Spider-Man fan and wanted to sit on the podcast with us, and this is my brother, Thomas Lack.
Hello.
Hello,
Thomas. I'm not that special.
Okay.
He's like extra special.
I like Spider-Man.
He does. Thomas, you may have, if you're a longtime listener of old versions of this podcast before it was tied to We Got This Covered, I don't think he ever appeared on the monthly stuff. He was on the monthly 10 several times.
Monthly stuff was kind of a stupid name.
Monthly stuff was the best name. Don't make fun of that.
That's the best podcast name ever.
Other than WGTC Radio, of course.
Yes.
The official podcast of WeGotThisCovered.com.
Visit us on the web at WeGotThisCovered.com.
Yes.
That was unnecessary.
I think it was very necessary.
Okay. So, we are going to talk about Spider-Man, as we said. So, Sean, I want you to sort of introduce the character and stuff, because I know he's your favorite superhero. You've read a lot of the comics, I know.
Yeah, I haven't read all of them. Don't say I've read. It's not like Doctor Who. It is a lot easier to watch all the Doctor Who episodes there are than to read every Spider-Man comic ever written.
This is true.
I mean, yeah, I've read a lot of Spider-Man comics, especially a lot of the earlier ones, like I've read all the Stan Lee and Steve Ditko originals, and then I lost Spider-Man a little bit in, like, the 80s and 90s, and then picked him up again more recently, and then stuff happened, but with Spider-Man. I'm curious, I was thinking about this the other day, I was thinking about Spider-Man stuff. Do you guys know about Brand New Day, the comic book that came out in 2006?
No.
Okay. Well, we can talk about that later, I think, but it destroyed Spider-Man comic books for, like, 3 or 4 years, basically.
Really?
Yeah, it was really terrible.
Was it part of the official continuity, or...?
Yeah, it destroyed official continuity. Long story short, Spider-Man made a deal with the devil to sacrifice his marriage with MJ to save Aunt May's life. And completely rebooted Spider-Man continuity and just, like, destroyed the fan base for a really long time.
I did hear about that. That was on, like, CNN. Like,
it was, like, the most catastrophic fuck-up in Spider-Man history. And they've just, like... And recently, some of, like, the Dan Slott Spider-Man stuff has been getting better. But, yeah... That was when, it was really funny because that happened right when I was picking up Spider-Man comic books again and kind of destroyed my faith for a little bit. But I luckily had the Spider-Man movies to come back to.
Yeah.
And I've always felt that the Spider-Man movies really captured, the Sam Raimi ones, captured what I like about Spider-Man. Because they did big Spider-Man stories and really, they really did the character justice, I feel. A lot of people think they didn't do the, like, really witty, happy, funny Spider-Man. But really... Spider-Man's only witty, happy, and funny in, like, the smaller issues of Spider-Man. What the Spider-Man movies did is they brought the really big stories where Spider-Man's dealing with really big issues, and Spider-Man's not so happy, you know, when his girlfriend's getting dropped off a bridge.
Right, and I think the other thing to note is that they really, the Sam Raimi movies built this template for superhero movies going forward, especially the first one. I mean, the second one's later, and a lot of superhero movies were already coming out. But that first one, really, I feel like you look at that, and you see the DNA being built for the next decade of superhero films.
Yeah, and it definitely captured to me, like, the cheesiness of what, like, a superhero movie should be. Because superhero comics are extraordinarily cheesy, especially if you go back to the old school, like, Silver Age stuff, where the dialogue is just unbelievable. It's the cheesiest thing you could possibly imagine. Like, that's what all those... what you would call a cheesy movie, I think, is basically just taking off of comic books, really, because the dialogue's just awful. But in the Spider-Man movies, the dialogue tends to be pretty bad, but it's cheesy bad, and it warms your heart when you listen to it, because it's just fun, and it's engaging.
It does, and they picked a filmmaker, you know, in Sam Raimi, who can ride tonal shifts better than anyone else, and just go from cheesy as hell to really powerfully dramatic in like a heartbeat. And that's something, obviously, I mean, they made a bunch of great choices in making, especially those first two movies.
Yeah.
We'll talk about the third, and we're not as harsh on it as everyone else. But
yeah.
But there's definitely things to talk about there.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I wanted to ask this like 5 minutes ago.
Okay.
You said it
5 minutes ago.
Not five. You said it. I said like five. You said like it destroyed five. The continuity, that thing, whatever it was.
Oh, yeah.
Is there really like one solid continuity?
I know,
at one time there were like five comics running at the same
time. Oh, yeah. Well, there's the Marvel 616 universe, like the main Marvel universe, like all the Marvel comic books take place in, have their own continuity. Although, yeah, there are, with Spider-Man especially, there are so many comic books that there is... I mean, they all take place on the same continuity, but I'm sure if you looked into it, there would be, like, thousands of little tiny continuity errors between the individual comic books. I mean, Spider-Man especially, I remember when I was really into Spider-Man comic books, and I was looking on the web, and there was a guy who decided he wanted, his project was he wanted to read every Spider-Man appearance in Marvel comic books, at least, like, the main Marvel continuity. And by, like, Spider-Man appearance, I mean including, like, guest appearances with, like, the Fantastic Four and Daredevil and whatnot. And so he was having people help him, like, construct a list of, like, chronological appearances of Spider-Man. And it was just the most ridiculous thing I'd ever seen because, at a certain point when Spider-Man was really big and, like, was the main driving force for Marvel sales and comic books, he would have, like, literally four or five comic books a month. Or he would have, like, the Amazing Spider-Man comic, like, his main comic book line at one point was weekly. And they had, like, one comic book a week for a while. And this is completely ridiculous. It's up to, like, 600 issues now, just the Amazing Spider-Man. And then they've also got, like, Spectacular Spider-Man, Web of Spider-Man, Peter Parker Spider-Man, Marvel Knight Spider-Man, Avenging Spider-Man, which have all come in and out. Ultimate Spider-Man. The Ultimate Spider-Man's another continuity.
Yeah.
It's like, you've got, like, Marvel Zombie Spider-Man, Marvel Team-Up Spider-Man.
Marvel Zombie Spider-Man.
There's another universe in Marvel Comics called Marvel Zombies, and it's...
How have
basically,
I not heard of
it's,
this?
It's like the zombie apocalypse taking place in Marvel Universe. Some of them are pretty good. Yeah.
So what does Spider-Man do? Just, like, web up zombies and stuff? Or is he himself a zombie?
Like, basically all the Marvel heroes are zombies and Marvel Zombies.
Oh, nice.
But anyways, yeah, so there's... There's a lot of Spider-Man comic books, and he's their most popular character, so including all the guest appearances. I mean, he appears all the time in, like, Fantastic Four and Daredevil and all those comic books. It was completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, yeah. If you want to get into Spider-Man comic books and read all of them, good luck. You're going to spend a lot of money.
Yes.
Or a lot of time torrenting comics off the web, which I wouldn't recommend you do.
Yes. We here at WGTC Radio do not condone the piracy of information.
No, we don't. Or comic books.
Yes.
Especially comic books, because you might as well go...
Pay the 99 cents?
Yeah, seriously. Especially for the old ones, you can get, like, 100 Spider-Man comics for, like, $20 and, like, big anthology collections.
That's actually a question I wanted to ask you. So let's say someone loves Spider-Man, saw the movies or something, but is not familiar with the comics. Where would you recommend they start if they want to read some good Spider-Man comics?
Oh, God. That's a big question. I would say... Me, a lot of the ones that I read of the old ones were in these really big, I think they were called, like, the Essential Collections for Marvel comic books, and they had literally, I think, probably about, like, 50 to 70 issues in, like, one big trade paperback thing of the old school, like, Stan Lee, Steve Ditko stuff. And, but the only problem with those, I really liked them because you could just read them all back to back, but the how they were so cheap was they didn't have color, so it was almost kind of like a newspaper comic. And they... Wasn't a huge deal, but if you're like a big comic fan, they have more expensive collections that have like glossy pages and all the color in them. But yeah, I would really recommend the original run with Stan Lee and Steve Ditko. At least like some of them are kind of hard to get through because they're really cheesy, but a lot of it's really good stuff, and it's the origins of Spider-Man. A lot of Sam Raimi's Spider-Man stuff picks up that, and then even like and then going on to his I can't remember the name of the guy who picked up as the artist after Steve Ditko. But he did a lot of stuff, like a lot of the really famous Spider-Man stories, like Spider-Man No More, which is the Spider-Man 2 kind of comic book story where Spider-Man decides, I don't want to be Spider-Man. That was the first time he decided he didn't want to be Spider-Man, out of like the thousand times he decided. Then, of course, there's the death of Gwen Stacy stuff, and there's so much. I would recommend if you're just a fan of the character and you're not concerned with wanting to... and get involved in the mainline continuity, I would really recommend picking up the trade paperbacks of Ultimate Spider-Man, Because Ultimate Spider-Man up to... I read all of Ultimate Spider-Man up to issue about probably like 110 or so. And all of those are really, really good stories. They do Spider-Man well. He's in high school again. It kind of redoes continuity where he's with Mary Jane. It brings Gwen Stacy in later. But those really capture the character, and it's got a much more modern feel to it. And they're not... It's a much more modern style, so it's a lot easier to get into if you're not a big fan of Silver Age comic books. Because they have sort of, like, in the trade paperbacks, they have one overarching story across all the issues. Across, like, 10 issues will be basically one story instead of Spider-Man fights a supervillain every single issue. And eventually, they run out of supervillains, so then Spider-Man would fight, like, alien invasions, and then Spider-Man goes to the mall, and then it's, like, the old-school comic books. It's, like, you would have big issues where he's, like, fighting Doc Ock or the Vulture, and then... They can't do that every single month, so then they would do ridiculous stories. So with Ultimate Spider-Man, they really...
Spider-Man Goes to the Mall? I want to see that movie. I want to see that, like, they've run out of reboots and everything, so they just make Spider-Man Goes to the Mall.
I mean, there's so many ridiculous things with Spider-Man. Spider-Man fights Dracula, that's one. Spider-Man fights the Brazilian terrorist, the Tarantula. Because that's actually a pretty good issue, but it's kind of really ridiculous. But yeah, Ultimate Spider-Man, I would pick that up and read the older issues. I haven't read any since about issue 100 because it kind of fell off in quality around there. But I've heard they've done a lot of stuff in the Ultimate Universe.
Were those the Brian Michael Bendis ones?
Yeah, Brian Michael Bendis. Yeah, he's... Some people find his style a little bit annoying. I really like it because I think it really fits Peter Parker, and I think he kind of captures... Well, that high school feel.
I think
really
that's
well.
Something about Spider-Man is that stylistically you can do him in a lot of different ways. Yeah. He's a pretty malleable character that way.
Yeah, I agree. Because you can do... I mean, the biggest Spider-Man stuff, I think the really best Spider-Man stuff is the really tragic Spider-Man stuff.
Yeah.
The Spider-Man... I mean, a lot of people is like, oh, Batman's so dark, he's so gritty. But it's like, Spider-Man is the most tragic superhero of them all. Because
Batman, at the very least, has his money to fall back on.
And it's just like, and Spider-Man's... And Batman, it's like, his parents got killed and he's trying to fight crime. But it's like... But after that, it's like, every once in a while, something really bad will happen in Batman's life. But Batman's, like, emotionally locked down at that point. It's like, Spider-Man, Jesus Christ, is like, you know, he doesn't have his parents, and he's living with his aunt and his uncle. His uncle gets killed. Spider-Man has to support his aunt while also being Spider-Man. He can't use his powers to make money, and his powers often make him have to spend extra money for, like, web fluid and fixing his web shooters and fixing his costume. So he's always trying to get money. Like, the public hates Spider-Man because of J. Jonah Jameson. He works for J. Jonah Jameson and gives him pictures so J. Jonah Jameson can make Spider-Man a hated public figure. His girlfriend gets killed. His aunt gets, like, kidnapped hundreds of times, and her life is constantly in danger because of him.
His friends are always mad at him.
Yeah, his friends are always mad. Like, and, like, everyone he cares about eventually gets killed. It's, like, it's completely ridiculous. Spider-Man's super tragic character, and it's really... Some of the stories are so dark.
Well, that's something that, you know, like, there's been this recent trend in superhero movies where they want to show a superhero in real life, and people act like that's a new thing. That's the basis of Spider-Man.
Yeah, that's the basis of all those old-school Marvel comic books. Yeah, is that...
This is a regular high schooler, and that's the power of the Spider-Man mythos.
Yeah, is that he's really, really a relatable character, because he has real-life problems that he's constantly trying to deal with, along with him fighting, you know, Dr. Octopus as Spider-Man. Yeah.
And I think that's something Thomas and I noticed when we rewatched the trilogy, something Sam Raimi had so much fun with, is everyone hates Peter Parker so much. It's hilarious.
It's the old Parker look, my friend.
Were you going to say something, Thomas?
Nope.
Okay. Yeah.
I thought I might, and then you started talking, and I didn't feel like it anymore.
Okay.
You want to talk about the movies now?
I think we're getting there.
I think we kind of were talking about the movies. We're talking about Spider-Man.
I mean, do you want to, like, more specifically?
Well, I actually was about to say this to Sean. Uh-huh. So let's go. 2002. That's when Sam Raimi's Spider-Man comes out.
2002.
Yes. What was
a year with two twos.
What was your...
And two zeros.
Yes. Very good, Thomas.
What was your familiarity with Spider-Man in 2002 preparing for the movie?
That's a good question. 2002 was a really long time ago.
10 years.
Yeah. I mean, I would have read quite a bit of the older Spider-Man stuff because my dad collected comics when he was a kid. So, like, when all the Marvel Silver Age stuff was happening. So, yeah, we have a lot of those really old comic books. And I read a lot of those. So I was fairly familiar with the Spider-Man character. Like, I was a fan of comic books at that time. But I wasn't, like, not like now, where it's like I know a lot, because I've read a lot of Spider-Man comic books at this point.
But were you excited for the movie?
Fuck yeah. Yeah. I mean, how could you not be?
I know. That was, the marketing for that movie was fucking awesome.
I mean, or really, it's all you need to do is have, like, a poster with, like, Spider-Man in that awesome Spider-Man costume that they did. It's yeah. like, that's all the marketing you needed, because everyone knows who Spider-Man is.
Yeah.
This is just, yeah, and just all the trailers were really exciting, like, because there weren't superhero movies that much back then.
No.
Like, it's not like now where, you know, Marvel has all the superhero movies coming out, and we have the Batman movies, and everyone's always trying to do a reboot of, like, Green Lantern or Superman or Wonder Woman or whatever is always in the news for DC. But yeah, Spider-Man was one of the earlier ones, and it was, for me, Spider-Man was the one that really was, like, the big superhero movie for me. Like, because,
what, no, X-Men? I think so, too.
Did
yeah.
X-Men come out earlier than Spider-Man 1?
Yeah, X-Men was 2 years earlier. But, I mean, to me, again, I'm talking about, like, the mold of superhero movies. Spider-Man, I always think of as the kickoff point because it really put everything in place that we were going to need for future superhero movies in terms of figuring out what the formula was going to be.
Yeah.
And very much emphasizing the human side of things.
Yeah, thank God they didn't, like, give Spider-Man, like, a leather suit like he did with all the X-Men.
Yeah, that would have been bad. Well, that's one of the things, is that the marketing, a choice in the movie that led to marketing success is they didn't change the suit. It's just, it's the classic Spidey outfit. It looks awesome. And I don't even remember if trailers had, like, footage of, like, Tobey Maguire in it. It was just shots of the suit and stuff. There was that great teaser that you can't find easily now because they pulled it, but it was him flying around the World Trade Centers.
Yeah.
That was so epic. Oh,
you mean swinging around?
Yeah, swinging around.
It's just, like, I just got a mental image of Spider-Man's flying like Superman around the World Trade Center. It's like, that would have been a weird trailer.
Yes. They really got it wrong.
Yeah.
They got the colors right.
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
Dude, that's all I had to say.
Okay. Thank you for contributing, Thomas.
Moving on.
Okay, yes. Moving on. Yeah.
So, it is sort of interesting. Yeah, they marketed it great. I remember, like, I was not super familiar with Spider-Man. Like, I hadn't read a bunch of comics, but obviously I knew who he was.
Yeah.
And I don't remember what all shows I watched, but there were a million Spider-Man animated series, or there have been. And there were probably at least, like, two airing in repeats at when I was watching, like,
that's another thing I do remember watching the older, I think it was, like, the Fox Spider-Man one. That's, like, kind of, like, similar to the X-Men cartoon. That Spider-Man cartoon wasn't great, but I watched it all the time and loved it.
Yeah, so I knew it from that a little bit, but definitely the movie was sort of my kickoff for Spider-Man. Do you remember 2002 at all, Thomas?
No. I mean, I...
It was the year of 2 2s and 2 0s.
Yes, now that you say that, it's all coming back to me.
I thought it would.
Yeah. I very briefly, not briefly, barely remember that preview with the World Trade Centers and... Maybe remember seeing it for the first time, but not really, because I've seen it so many times now that the first... I mean, I was 7, so it doesn't seem like... I don't know. I wasn't paying that much attention, probably.
Yeah, you just thought it was cool.
Yeah.
We saw it several times in the theater, because it was pretty awesome.
Okay.
So let's talk about the movie itself.
Okay, itself.
Okay, so I've got a bunch of notes here. Thomas and I picked up the movies on Blu-ray the other day to watch the whole trilogy again, and that's actually something I want to talk about, is how this functions as a trilogy. Because now we know there's never going to be more in this continuity.
Mm-hmm.
And we watched them all in 3 days, just to get through them really fast and see how they played as a trilogy. And I also took notes in depth. So do we want to talk in depth about the movie, or sort of start with some general thoughts on what we think about the movie?
Just say something.
Say something.
Yeah. Okay, Sean, what's your general opinion on Spider-Man 1?
I really like it. I think it's not a great, great movie. It's certainly not as good as Spider-Man 2. But I think, because I recently rewatched... Well, I rewatched the first two. I didn't really feel like rewatching Spider-Man 3. Cause
I understand.
That one's not that great. But, yeah, with Spider-Man 1, it's a lot cheesier than Spider-Man 2. I think, especially, I noticed rewatching it recently, the dialogue is really, really cheesy in Spider-Man 1. I didn't quite remember that well. But, yeah, I really like it. I still think it does the origin story well, because it just gets right in there and does the origin right away from the beginning. It doesn't have... It's like, that's another thing I noticed. It's like, when you remember Spider-Man 1, you think the origin stuff takes up almost the entire movie, which the movie is about his origin. But he actually, Spider-Man gets bitten by the spider, and Osborn gets, like, the, whatever the Green Goblin stuff is, injected into him, like, 10 minutes into the freaking movie. Like, it's right at the very beginning.
That's something that is fascinating about the Spider-Man origin, is that his origin isn't about the actual spider bite, it's about what happens after that.
Yeah, it's about the aftermath and him reacting and trying to figure out what he's going to do with his powers.
Yeah, and again, what it does to him, what it does to Peter Parker as a human. So, I agree. I really like this one. I actually like it more the older I get. And I don't quite know what that is. It's just that I'm growing more used to it or what. But, like, when we watched it this time, I had not seen it in a while. And I loved every minute of the damn thing. It was so much fun.
Yeah.
And they do so many things right. And I think I was, you know, watching it with a much more critical eye than I normally would. Because we're doing it. I was taking notes, doing it for a podcast. And it just, it holds up really well. And obviously there are things about it that if it were made today would be different, maybe would be better, but on the whole, I think it for it to work the way it did, it had to be made before the big wave.
Yeah.
It had to be the start of it, because they were feeling their way out with this one. There wasn't a pre-existing template for how to do a Spider-Man movie, and it's really impressive to watch them do it. And I think I want to, this is where I want to go in depth.
Okay.
Is...
What about Thomas? Thomas?
Thomas, what's your overall thoughts on Spider-Man?
Well, okay. The thing I'm thinking about right now is just how much everyone hates Peter in that movie. Like, yeah, the first scene, it opens and he's talking about Mary Jane, and then you see him running alongside the bus. That bus driver, and everybody on the bus, everyone at his school, just hates Peter so much.
And we never know why.
Yeah, it's like, what
it's because he's a nerd. Nerd. Yeah, no. And that's actually one of the really things I really love about Tobey Maguire as Peter Parker is that Tobey Maguire looks like a goddamn nerd. Like
he does.
He definitely is able to kind of capture that sort of social outcast.
It's something that I wonder about how Andrew Garfield is going to be able to do, because Andrew Garfield is a tall, strapping, you know, like people agree he's a handsome, like movie star guy. Mm-hmm. Tobey Maguire was not.
And yeah, no. Like Tobey Maguire doesn't look like a movie star. He looks like an actual, like, human being.
Yeah. And actually, that's where I want to start, is the economy of this movie and how quickly they set things up and how well they establish these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And that they start the movie, and this is a really good choice that Sam Raimi made that he could have missed, but I think he did well, is starting at small scale.
Yeah.
It's a big superhero movie, but you start it just, he's running after the bus. It doesn't look big budget. It doesn't look, you know, big or epic in scope. It's just a high school story. And that's how it starts. And that's how it has to start for me, because you have to forge these human connections for the action later on to have impact.
Yeah, and especially you really need to establish Peter Parker as he is before he gets his powers. And you need to understand who he is.
And that's where the economy of it comes in, is that just in a couple minutes, they establish so well who Peter Parker is, who Harry Osborn is, who Mary Jane is, and these performances...
Flash Thompson.
Yeah. These performances are all so good, and they just establish these characters so well, and I think that's... We do need to talk about these lead performances, because there's something that's been disturbing me lately online.
Yeah. Disturbing.
So The Amazing Spider-Man is coming out, and people are excited about it, and they should be. It looks good. There's lots of things to be excited about. It's new. It's fresh. But now there's There's this weird backlash to the Raimi films that I don't understand. Yeah. Especially to Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst. And I have no qualms in saying they are brilliant in these movies. They are fantastic performances. Are they, like, deep, you know, Shakespearean? Not necessarily, but it's, as comic book performances go, this is the best of the best to me. I think Tobey Maguire especially is just fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, like it said earlier, a lot of people feel that the essence of Spider-Man is Spider-Man being really witty and funny, because, I mean, that's a big trademark of him in the comic books, Spider-Man didn't start out especially witty and funny. He had some one-liners, but every comic book superhero had their one-liners.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone, like, that's how you wrote comic books, and that's still kind of how you have to write them, is that you have the little, like, action movie-style quips all the time. But that, like, they really picked it up with Spider-Man. That became a really iconic part of his character, was that he was always going off with the quips during the fights, except for when shit got really real. You know, he wasn't quipping at Green Goblin when he was throwing Gwen Stacy off the frickin' bridge. You know, he's not going to quip at Doc Ock when he's about to kill Aunt May.
He didn't yell, like, let's play catch as he jumped
over. Yeah, it's like, yeah. It's like, you got a really bad arm, Gobby. Like, Spider-Man's not making cracking jokes right then, you know? So, and I think the most important part of, at least Peter Parker to me, is that he's a social outcast and that he isn't able to easily connect with people, and that him being Spider-Man is almost a sort of release, and that he's able to sort of be outgoing and be who he wants to be because he's able to be behind the mask.
And Tobey Maguire captures that so well. First in sort of his frustration with his normal life, and then in the joy he exudes when he becomes Spider-Man and he learns to have these powers. It's just like, especially the scene where he's first training and figuring out how he can
do this. I love that when he's, even though the CGI with Spider-Man 1 is really bad.
Right.
But it's like, that was one of the things I noticed when I was rewatching this. Like, oh my god, this literally looks worse than like an in-game Xbox 360 graphics.
It does at this point.
It really does. But just like, I really love those scenes where he's just, like, he's just so excited. Like, he's like yelling and he's leaping over the rooftops and he's... And then, like, every time he's, like, I've noticed, like, when he's swinging in the background, you'll hear him, they're like, woohoo! It's like, he's really happy all the time when he's just, like, out swinging and jumping around, because it's like, wouldn't you be? Like, that looks really freaking awesome. Yeah, it's just like, he does bring so much joy, and he's so happy about it. It's really infectious.
And I would even argue, I mean, Tobey Maguire is so good at capturing the... really the dramatic moments. I mean, he's very good at the humor and the joy, but it's just sort of the... There's a lot of... I don't want to use the word angst, because it's a word that has kind of a loaded meaning, but, you know, angst. Peter Parker is a guy with a lot on his plate.
Kidding!
And Tobey Maguire, you know, is able to capture that in a way that never feels heavy-handed. It feels natural to who this guy is. And he gets better as the series goes along.
Yeah. Even.
But he's, again, immediately in Spider-Man 1, he is this character to the degree where when I'm watching it, I can't imagine anyone else animated, like voiceover or live action or anything, playing that part. He just inhabits it so well. If we were living in a different era 10 years later where, like, blockbuster films have been more accepted into the critical mainstream, I always have to wonder if Tobey Maguire would ever have been part of, like, the Oscar conversation, especially for Spider-Man 2, which we'll get to. But he's just really, really good in these. And so is Kirsten Dunst. And obviously, you know, as we go through the movie, there's a lot more Mary Jane, but right from the beginning, there's sort of this really natural ease to her performance where it... Obviously, neither of these people look like teenagers.
Yeah.
But that's just part of it. That's how it works, I guess.
Yeah.
But...
What?
Thomas? Well, they didn't make them seniors, you know? They don't look like that either, but at least it's like they're trying.
Right, and I think that's an interesting choice, is that these are mostly college-focused than
high school. It definitely is taking place at the end of his high school career and then into college.
And so he doesn't look overly old or anything, but what I was just trying to say is that Kirsten Dunst looks... She's very natural in this performance. And I love watching her in these movies, and especially her scenes with Tobey Maguire. You want to talk about chemistry in movies? That should be, like, the first page of a textbook on, like, chemistry between actors. They were so well cast together. And just even from the first scene where he's just sort of innocently taking pictures of her and they're clipping back and forth, to sort of the big dramatic scenes, like, where they're talking about sort of their hopes and desires. Again, this is the sort of stuff that in a lot of high school, college dramas can get either boring or forced really fast.
Yeah.
And they can do it here to where... Here's a good example. The scene good where example. Aunt May is in the hospital, and Aunt May is pretending to be asleep while Peter and Mary Jane are talking, and Peter is saying, you know, through Spider-Man, or Spider-Man through Peter, what he thinks of Mary Jane. It's convoluted, and the dialogue is not on the page all that good, but they sell it to the point where it's like, it really... You feel it. It's like...
Yeah.
It certainly seems authentic there.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's like... He's face-to-face with the girl he loves, and she's actually, like, maybe giving him a chance, because now she says he's in love with Spider-Man, and he's just sort of making shit up. So the dialogue isn't that good, but it wouldn't be, and so the way he delivers it really...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how I for him. That's exactly how I felt when I was rewatching the movie, is that, a lot of that dialogue is really clunky and kind of clumsy, even, like, just, like, how it's written. And I don't know if this is intentional, but, when they act it out, it really does... Even though it's really poorly written dialogue, it really feels like something that actual people would say.
And part of that is, again, you know, Tobey Maguire gets the brunt of the dialogue in those scenes, but Kirsten Dunst's reactions feel so organic and authentic, and they're just so much fun to watch together.
Yeah.
So we're at the laboratory scene.
Laboratory scene.
Yes.
The first one?
Yeah.
First one.
Yes, the laboratory scene... Peter gets bitten, which, again, we love how fast they do that.
Yeah.
But Thomas and I had a big question.
Yeah.
Peter does not, like, swat the spider or kill it. It goes away. Wouldn't that spider go on to make, like, an army of Spider-Men?
Well, I think presumably, you know, they would catch it, because if they spent, you know, probably thousands and thousands of dollars making these genetically altered super spiders, first off, they'd probably make sure the one right in the middle didn't escape.
They'd probably catch it. I do love that, like, they point that out as, like, one of the spiders is missing, and then the Asian scientist is like, they're probably testing on it. It's like, you don't want to go check, but you're like... Yeah, your, like, billion-dollar research specimen isn't going out biting people and turning them into superheroes?
Yeah, it's...
I also don't know what part of, like, genetic modification includes being able to rewrite a victim's DNA through venom. Like, how the fuck did they do that on that spider? That's pretty freaking... That's like,
and how did none of these scientists, like, figure out that this is where Spider-Man came from?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I do. I mean, it makes a little bit more sense than the actual origin story of radioactive right. spider bites you and that rewrites your DNA somehow. But at least, like, they did that in the 60s where, like, radioactivity was magic and could do anything.
Yeah,
like,
no one knew anything about science and these sorts of things.
I do love that part of the movie.
There's a lot of great sort of bad science moments in this. In this movie, one of my favorite lines in the movie is when Norman Osborn is talking to his assistant. He's, you know, Norman is about to get in the chamber, and he says, "Risks are part of laboratory science." And I'm like, "No, they aren't." What?
You're supposed to minimize risks, you maniac. It's like, I also just like, they don't have medical personnel on hand while they're performing an incredibly dangerous experiment for the first time. It's just Osborn and, like, the bald scientist dude.
Yes.
It's like, don't you want some other people there maybe to help with the experiment?
Or that Norman, under any circumstances, like, their bylaws would be allowed to do this to himself. It's just great.
Well, you know, in that same scene, he drinks that thing that's supposed to stabilize his muscles or something, and then he breaks the vial on the floor. Yeah, like, what kind of scientist just breaks glass?
It catalyzes the agent when it hits the bloodstream.
Yeah.
Like, do you...
And then he's all tough there, and then he sits in the lab bench, and he's just like, it's cold.
I love that. I remember that line when I don't know why, but I just remember that when I first saw the movie. It's like, they put the thing, and I was like, it's cold. And I was like, that's exactly what my reaction would have been. It's really a weird moment, because you don't think, you wouldn't really, like, you think most people would have just cut that out, and like, because I feel like Willem Dafoe said that because it actually was cold, and it was like, he was like, he didn't realize, like, it's cold, and was like, most directors, I feel, is like, just cut, let's do that again. It's like, no.
It seemed like
probably would have been pretty cool.
It seemed like an improvisation, or that he just broke character accidentally, because it comes down, and it's not just how you're saying it, it's very vulnerable, like, it's cold!
Yeah, it's like, and it's just like, it's really quick, it's like, it's cold, and it's like, okay, then like, cuts right after he says it, it's like, that was a really weird little character moment. Osborn doesn't like having cold metal touched to him.
But let's talk about that. So that's really where
the
movie goes.
That's the key to Green Goblin's character, yes. I think, that it was cold.
Yeah.
That's why he became green. That's why he's killing people.
He was angry, like, at the moment. Angry. That
it's like, that was so cold, I'm going to kill you!
Well, then maybe we want to talk about Norman Osborn and Willem Dafoe, which is still one of the most wacky pieces of superhero casting of all time.
I do.
I like him. I think
I'm not saying bad. Yeah, it is wacky. It is.
Yeah, it's... Like, Green Goblin is the weirdest part of that, the Spider-Man one to me, like, because... I mean, Green Goblin is, like, completely insane and a really crazy character in the comic books, too, but it's, like, it's not quite like that. Like, I don't know, there's something really weird. They do the whole, like, split personality thing and everything.
I kind of like that choice, though, because it's Sam Raimi obviously using his horror background to do this Jekyll and Hyde thing, and it's simultaneously hilarious where I'm laughing at it and also kind of intimidating. And it works really well.
All the scenes where he's talking to himself in the mirror, I think that's what you were kind of talking about. They're so ridiculous. Because he's like so innocent. He's like, no, we didn't do that. And the Goblin's like, we killed them. And it's, I don't know, it's just ridiculous.
It's just like, and just like all the dialogue is really overdramatic. And like, he's got like the huge chair and like the goblin helmet's like hanging off of one end. It's like, you've got the big mirror and like the fireplace is on. It almost looks like the scene in The Big Lebowski where it's like, you know, you've got the Lebowski like talking this like, strong Ben. Also cry. It's like super overdramatic lighting and like in the set and everything. It's just like,
and Willem Dafoe, I love when he's like crawling on all fours towards the mask. It's just like, I get the feeling like they had him in a cage off stage, and then when he was ready for scenes, they like took him off the leash and threw him out there.
Yeah, it's just, but it also has, it's such a huge contrast to when it like will cut to Peter Parker and it's like he's in a scene with like JJ. And it's like, it's really funny and happy, and then it cuts to this, like, we will kill Spider-Man. No, we can't kill him!
Yeah.
It's like, what the hell is with this scene?
And it's sort of funny, because I think, on some levels, I don't know if it fits totally, but I couldn't imagine the movie without it, and I kind of love it.
I kind of love it, too, especially, I really love the scene where Gobby kidnaps Spider-Man, and they're, like, on the rooftop, and Spider-Man's, like, chained, and they're just, like, having this conversation.
In mask?
Yeah, and Green Goblin is so casual about it. Like, at one point, he, like, kind of, like, slaps him on the head and, like, leans up against, like, the radiator or whatever it was.
And like, I don't know. It's funny to me because he doesn't take the opportunity to unmask him, and then Norman spends the next 30 minutes of the movie trying to figure out who Spider-Man is.
The funniest line of dialogue in the whole movie happens right before that scene. You know, when the Green Goblin comes and blows up the wall behind Jameson?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Spider-Man appears and he's like, sleep.
I love it. That's just one of those moments where it's like, most directors would say, that's a terrible line reading, get rid of it. But Sam Raimi has this like vision to say, no, that will be awesome, put it in.
Sleep.
It's great. But that actually does lead, you were talking about the shifts between scenes.
Yeah.
That is one of my only like things I would change about this movie, is I feel the first act should be focused on Peter, and I don't like that in the early going they're cutting between,
mm-hmm.
because I feel like you need a little more time just with your POV character and then go into the villain, and that's what Spider-Man 2 does.
Yeah.
You don't break POV until he's turned into Dr. Octopus. Mm-hmm. And they do break POV almost right away, and it's a little disconcerting.
Yeah, like the first 20 minutes or so of the movie is like doing both of their origins sort of simultaneously, like a little cut between them.
But talking about origins, we need to talk about Aunt May and Uncle Ben, who are two of my favorite film characters of all time.
Yeah, I really love May and Ben in this movie.
Like, I actually kind of wish for The Amazing Spider-Man. Okay, Cliff Robertson's dead. I guess they couldn't get him back. Rest in peace, Cliff Robertson. But mm-hmm. I wouldn't have minded if, you know, an alternate universe where Cliff Robertson is still alive, they had just gotten him and Rosemary Harris back for the reboot. Because I can't imagine anyone else in those parts.
They're really, really good.
Yeah, even, and the best parts of Spider-Man 3 are the scenes with Rosemary Harris, mm-hmm. still. I mean, she's just so good, and obviously Cliff Robertson has less to do, but the amount of time it takes him to establish everything you need to know about Uncle Ben is all of 5 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, they just have that one scene with Ben and May in the apartment before Peter comes home. They're just sort of, like, talking to each other.
And you see how much these people love and need each other, and how much they love their nephew,
mm-hmm.
and how much it is a family relationship. Where, you know, okay, Peter's an orphan, I guess, but that doesn't matter to these people.
Yeah.
These are his parents. They all love each other very much. They're almost, you know, he and Ben are like good friends almost.
Yeah.
You know, and just that, those relationships are established so well. And I guess I want to jump ahead to the scene where, because we already talked about Peter sort of discovering his powers and stuff, but
the scene. Can we go back with the scene where Peter's discovering his powers? The one thing. It was a scene I had completely forgotten about until I was rewatching the movie, where he's trying to figure out how to shoot his web.
Oh, great scene!
It's like, I forgot, it's like, it's so freaking cheesy, like he's doing all these different hand signals and just like,
go web!
Yeah, go web, go! Up, up and away, web! Shazam! And he's like throwing out all these like comic book references, and it's like, this is really, it's like, it's really weird because the scene, it's like, they like stop the music right where that's in, like, it's like this little, like, comedy skit, and then he figures it out, and then, like, it's like the scene starts again.
But I love that, and it's, you know, Sam Raimi was really good at just integrating humor naturally into these movies.
Yeah.
And even then, it's obviously a very obvious stop for humor, but it works really well. Yeah.
I think there was some unintentional humor. I saw this a lot, you wrote it down in your notes. When he first wakes up after, the day after he gets bitten, and he's looking in the mirror at himself, and Aunt May asks if everything's all right.
And he goes, I don't know if Tobey Maguire made a mistake here, but he goes, yup, looks down, looks up, and says, big change. And
she says, it's like, are you all right? Are you better? Is there any change?
Yeah.
Yeah, she says, yes.
I know, and I'm saying he looks at his pants and says, big change, and then looks back up.
Oh, okay. And yeah, I didn't see that.
I mean, that's just weird.
Thomas pointed that out.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Okay, let's, what were we talking about?
Thomas.
Before? Well, apparently we're talking about Tobey Maguire's junk.
Yeah, Thomas is here to make penis jokes on the podcast.
Screw you.
Anyway, the other scene I want to talk about before we get to the big stuff with Uncle Ben, actually, is the Flash Thompson fight.
I love that movie.
That is the most, like, satisfying bully beat-up scene in any movie. It's so great.
Why?
Because he doesn't even mean to do it. It's awesome. Yeah.
But then, what? I don't understand, like, the whole rest of the movie, they're talking about that fight and how horrible it was what Peter did.
Flash would have killed him.
Flash was, like, punching lockers.
Yeah, like, there was that scene where he, like, he does the punch, and, like, the locker just gets, like,
thunk. Yeah.
It's like, Jesus!
Like, what would that have done if it hit Peter's head?
Yeah, seriously, this. Yeah, it's really weird, too, because I didn't, because I wasn't super familiar with the comic books when I first watched the movie, and Flash Thompson is actually, like, he's a really fleshed out character. Like, he's a, especially now in comic books, like, he was one of the original characters, cast of characters, and he still, like, shows up in Spider-Man comic. I don't know what he's doing after the, after Brand New Day just destroyed everything.
Yeah.
Or One More Day, or whatever. It's like, that was the other thing with Brand New Day. After that, they named every, like, story arc something doing with Day, so I can't keep any of them straight anymore. But yeah, but with, like, Flash Thompson, like, he in the comic books, he has, like, this, one of the interesting relationships with Peter and Flash is that, yeah, Flash is sort of a bully to Peter, but he's not that much, like, he's not, like, the super one-dimensional, dude, I'm just going to punch people because they're nerds in this movie, basically.
Yeah.
But in the comic books, yeah, it's like he makes fun of Peter and he's like the big jock and everything. But he also has this really deep respect for Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And like he idolizes Spider-Man and he sort of wants to be Spider-Man and he's always defending Spider-Man. So there's this really interesting relationship. And this movie is like, no, Flash Thompson is just like, he's just a jackass bully.
Well, and you never see him again after
yeah.
that. He's
not... He has the car.
Well, I mean, yeah, but you don't even really see him in that scene.
I think that's
and there's the scene where he breaks up with MJ for like 30 seconds into Graduation.
Yeah.
It's just like, yeah, so he has very little screen time, but I was like, I didn't even realize when I first watched the movie, or even for a while, that was Flash Thompson. Because I never really caught it, because he's a really minor character.
Yeah.
It's just like, and then I was like, oh, that's Flash. It's like, huh, they made you kind of an asshole, Flash. I kind of like you in the comic books.
Yep. So, okay, so let's talk about, really, this is where the Spider-Man's origin really lies, is the scene with Uncle Ben in the car, and then the scene where Uncle Ben is killed, and Peter is, you know, somewhat responsible for it. And I wrote down in my notes that scene where Ben is talking to Peter in the car when he's dropping him off, mm-hmm. and that's the great power comes great responsibility speech. That scene was, like, iconic even before the movie came out.
Yeah.
From trailers and stuff, and it's such a good scene. Like, we're talking about clunky dialogue. The dialogue in that scene is great. And mm-hmm. I don't know if they just pulled it from earlier comic stuff or what, but it's...
If they did, it wouldn't have been great.
It's a really powerful scene, and they're not afraid to make Peter a little ugly in this section.
Yeah.
And sort of...
Kind of an asshole.
Yeah. And, I mean, you have to do that because then he, you know, he has to have something to redeem. And that's just really interesting, and I really love how they do it. And again, Cliff Robertson, that's, I guess, his last scene, but he's so good in it.
Yeah. And
obviously, he has lots of flashback scenes,
mm-hmm.
but really great stuff.
Yeah, it's just like, I can't get over how good Uncle Ben. Like, they did that character so well in this movie, and even yet, he doesn't have a lot of screen time because he gets killed off, obviously, pretty early. But yeah, all the moments he has with Peter, like, they build him up as such a realistic father figure.
Yeah.
And, like, that conversation really feels like an actual conversation that, like, a teenager would have with, like, I mean, he's not his dad, but...
Yeah.
It's just, like, it's so well done. But one thing that it's, like, I'm always really curious about is when the line, great with great power comes great with responsibility, became such a huge deal. Because in the actual comic books, like, because it's in the first issue, that line isn't actually spoken by a character. It's, like, in the last box of narration at the very end. It's like, and Peter learned that with great power must come great responsibility. It's like, or whatever. And I've always, and since it's like, don't know that much about Spider-Man before this movie came out, and obviously, like, this movie, like, the line's a really big deal in this movie, I'm always curious about when it became a huge deal in the comic books.
Yeah.
Because it was, like, it wasn't, like, I don't know if they ever retconned it as Uncle Ben having told it to Peter. I always find that really interesting because it's such a hugely iconic moment.
Yeah, and it's been dramatized, I know, in other mediums, like the Spectacular Spider-Man animated series that's given to Uncle Ben.
Yeah, in Ultimate Spider-Man it is too.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm always just really curious about when that became such a hugely iconic line, because it's not, like, you know, Spider-Man's never dwelling over it in the comic books, at least the ones that I've read. He's never, like, thinking about, oh, Uncle Ben told me that with great power comes great responsibility.
But it really, he never did. I think it's a great choice.
Yeah.
Because to have those be Uncle Ben's basically final words to him, he always has this cloud over his head. And that's sort of the emotional arc that Raimi chooses for the trilogy, is Peter learning to forgive himself.
Yeah.
While still kind of holding his uncle's message in his heart. And they do that well. And then, of course, the entire sequence that follows with Uncle Ben's death. And we'll get back to the wrestling match and stuff, because that's fun. But they...
Boom! So he's ready!
The impact of Uncle Ben's death. That scene is done so well. And for a movie that is so much fun and has so many funny moments, to have a dramatic moment that powerful is really cool.
Yeah.
And it hits home really hard, and it's, you know, there's a ripple effect from that scene through the rest of the trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And it just works so well. Just the way they stage it and everything, especially to where the Danny Elfman music, which is so good, and we will talk about it in a little bit, but the Danny Elfman music swells as Peter runs away from his uncle's body and he pulls on the mask and jumps into action for the first time. It's as satisfying as movie moments come. Mm-hmm. It's just great on every level. So,
and then also one of the things I really love is, like, it kind of realizes at that moment is because it's like, yeah, he puts on the mask and then he jumps and he learns how to web swing.
Yeah.
And how they do the web swinging in this movie is really incredible to me because they really capture a feeling to it that isn't present anywhere else in Spider-Man, or at least up to that point, because before it was comic books, it's a very static medium. And so you don't get that sensation of, oh, he's swinging through the air that well. Like, I mean, you obviously, like, every single Spider-Man comic book starts with Spider-Man swinging through New York City. It's like a law in Spider-Man comic books has to start that way. And he's complaining to himself about something.
Yeah.
But it's like, that's how it always is. It's like, it's not a huge thing, because you never get that feeling. And then even in the cartoons up to that point, or even, like, the video games, he would just be, like, swinging, just, like, shooting web through the air and just kind of moving, and it would just be a transition to something else. Like, in the old Spider-Man video game for, like, I think it was for the N64, it was, like, you would be standing on a rooftop, there would be no route, like, buildings or anything around you, you would jump, and you just shoot two webs in the air and just, like, swing forward. It's like, what the hell is he swinging on?
I remember that very well from old games.
And in the Spider-Man, the video game adaptation of this movie, they also kind of did a similar thing where he would just web through random space. Just like he just webbed something.
There was a cloud up there made of steel or something.
Until the Spider-Man 3 video game that they did
Spider-Man 2 video game.
Okay.
From the game.
Did you really have to, like, attach to something, though?
Yeah. It had that mechanic. That was the first one that did that. Yeah, and then they did, like, Ultimate Spider-Man and Spider-Man 3. And that web-swinging mechanic was so good in those games. But when I was watching the movie again, I was realizing, it's like, they really capture that feeling really well. Like, there's one really specific moment when he's, like, web-swinging where he's about to hit the wall, and then he shoots another web, and he's still holding on to this one. And it's like, the physics of it just feels so right, where he, like, he skims the wall and, like, goes onto that other web and lets go of the first one. Then he starts swinging. It's like, they just captured that feeling so well, and they had to sort of invent how the web swinging would look and work because it hadn't ever been done in a sort of realistic way before.
Right, and it's the camera work is just phenomenal, and it's innovative. No one had moved cameras quite like that for that kind of mechanic. And I don't even know. There's a lot of bad CGI in this one, and I know kind of how they did it, but I still don't quite figure out how they put it all together to make it look as good as it does.
Yeah,
and it's really cool, but let's go back to the bone saw scene.
Bone saw!
Bruce Campbell as the announcer who christens Spider-Man as the amazing Spider-Man. Fucking love it, Bruce Campbell.
I love Bruce Campbell and everything, but yeah, I love that whole sequence is so great where he backs up and is like, what's your name, kid? The Human Spider. That's it? That's the best you got? God, that sucks. The amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah.
It's like, and then the curtain goes up, and it's like, he got my name wrong. It's the Human Spider. It's like, just that whole sequence is so Sam Raimi, but I love that so much because I think it's really freaking funny.
It is, and we'll talk about the other Bruce Campbell cameos when we get to movies 2 and 3, but my sort of grand unified Bruce Campbell theory, I've one of two. He's either the same person in every movie who just keeps getting new jobs and is always being a dick to Peter Parker, or the third one, I guess, he decides he wants to help him out, or he's Peter's spiritual guide sent down by God to, like, push him in the right direction at pivotal moments in life.
I mean, that makes sense because in the Spider-Man movie video games, Bruce Campbell was like, was like the tutorial voice, basically.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I guess that makes a lot of sense. I'm pretty sure that's canonical with these movies now.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure we just cracked the puzzle.
If they had gone on with the Sam Raimi series to, like, Spider-Man 12, where they had adapted the Brand New Day, he would be the devil.
He's Mephisto, or it's like he's like the Beyonder or something. He's like, no, he's Uatu the Watcher. He's like sort of like, he's not supposed to get involved, but he, like, drops little cryptic hints.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. I love the bone saw fight.
With Macho Man, Randy Savage. That whole sequence is so great. And they've got, like, all the people just like, kill him!
Yeah.
Kill him!
It's, like, so stereotypical.
Like, yeah, and, like, the cage is coming down, and it's like, I was like, cage, 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 cage.
And they pass Bonesaw a chair through the cage bars.
Even though it's like he's fighting some kid who, like, answered a newspaper advertisement. Yeah, they give him a chair to smack him in the face with.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Oh, yeah. Snap into a Slim Jim.
Yes. Okay. Randy Savage is awesome.
Boom. So, okay. He's really...
We've gotten through all that and sort of Spidey's first scene where he really becomes Spider-Man. And what's next in the movie?
What is next in the movie? You've got your notes. It's probably something with Osborn killing people.
Yeah, I think it is.
He blows up like that bunker.
Yeah. I think really...
It's sort of like a throwaway scene, though.
Yeah, and I think it's just sort of growing through that, going through the Uncle Ben grief, high school graduation. Lots of great material with Aunt May, comforting Peter, and sort of dealing with her own grief. Again, Rosemary Harris is just awesome. Like, I want a spin-off movie about Aunt May just going through her day and, like, just being an awesome human being, you know?
Yeah, I'm not going that far with it. Okay. I really like Aunt May in this movie, but I think that would be a little bit boring.
Okay. Anyway, but
fights Doc Ock or something. Or maybe that's where she marries Doc Ock.
Really?
What? Well, she almost marries Doc Ock in the books, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. It's just like, Peter's got a lot on his plate sometimes in the comic books.
Yes.
Like, my 80-year-old aunt is about to marry, like, my 60-year-old arch nemesis who's a German scientist with robot arms. My life is weird.
All right. I want to talk about Spidey, like, with the proper suit and everything. His introduction?
Mm-hmm.
There really isn't one. He just kind of appears and is fighting crime, and I've always felt there's something lacking in that first montage.
Yeah.
Where they're sort of showing what he's doing, but you don't really get a sense of what Peter's doing and how he's dealing it. Like, I feel like there's a scene missing.
Yeah, it's like it just jumps right into, it has like, that whole crime montage where it's just like he's swinging around, stopping crimes really quick. It's like newspapers are going up. It's like, oh, you're Spider-Man. No.
And I don't know if there's literally like a scene missing there, or if it's just a clunky bit of writing or what. But it is an interesting scene.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have the introduction of J. Jonah Jameson. And good God, could J.K. Simmons be... He could not be better.
Yeah, there's no better casting of a character in any movie ever.
Yes.
Than J.K. Simmons as J. Jonah Jameson.
Yeah, we're talking Robert Downey Jr. levels of like Tony Stark.
I'm talking beyond that. Yeah, it's just... It's perfect. Like, there's no... It's so absolutely perfect. There's no way to describe how much he is that character.
And how much, like, it's like, and it's not like they had to redo his makeup and stuff. J.K. Simmons just looks like J. Jonah Jameson. He has that mustache in other movies, even. Mm-hmm. It's great. And he's so much fun to watch, and all the bugle scenes just are bursting with sort of life and vitality.
Yeah, and just all this energy where it's like you'll have, like, people just, like, jumping into his office trying to, like, get something solved. You have, like, Betty Brant and... Like Robertson, like whoever I don't even know who the other guy is who's like, he's sort of like Patsy that's always running into the Bugle office.
He's funny.
Yeah.
And it's sort of funny, you've got a younger and pre-famous Elizabeth Banks as Betty Brant.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a list, I think, on two of all the like characters who are in these movies, or actors in these movies who would go on to be famous, but were like just in bit parts in these. Mm-hmm. She's one of them, and that's fun. And they actually, this is really interesting, they reference Eddie Brock as their photographer.
Yeah, I caught that too when I rewatched it.
Continuity error.
Yeah, whatever. It could have just been a different Eddie.
That's true. Maybe that's the interesting Eddie. He's like stuck in the nether and the Topher Grace Eddie is like, has stolen his identity.
Yeah, that's the Eddie that's like 7 feet tall and is just like built out of muscle and for some reason he's a photographer.
Yeah.
I never got that in the comic books. It's like, he's just like, he looks like Dolph Lundgren or Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he's working as a photographer.
They make fun of that in the Spectacular Spider-Man TV series, where he's like, yeah, I decided to become a scientist instead of a footballer or whatever. Yeah, it's great.
A footballer?
I'm not a sports writer, I'm a
You're
movie
not a
writer.
Sporter?
I'm not a sporter. I'm a filmer. No, yeah.
I also do love how they, like, very sort of kind of hint at, like, Peter tries to hit on Betty Brant a little bit, which I liked because in the comic books, Betty is actually, like, I think she's the first girl that Peter actually goes out with. And then it's, like, when Stacy and all that stuff.
Yep. And Peter also references, like, working for Dr. Connors, which is another thing they would change in the next movie.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously this series never got to the Lizard.
Yeah.
But,
there were a lot of little tiny references to little things in this. That I hadn't caught the other times I'd seen the movie, because it's been quite a while since
you have to really see 2 and 3 and know where they were going to go with it to catch that these are errors and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Anyway, let's see. The next big event in the movie... Oh, actually, I want to ask you something else.
Yeah.
So Harry and Mary Jane start going out.
I forgot about that subplot.
How the fuck did that happen?
Yeah, it's such a small little thing in the movie, too. Like, it's just like they have this little tiny thing, and it's like they build a little bit of tension between Peter and Harry because Harry's going out with MJ. But yeah, it's like... It's just like a really weird moment because it's like, yeah, it feels really out of place because Harry and MJ's relationship was never sort of built up and established at all, like, other than they had like two scenes together before they were dating. Yeah. And it's like, even that it's like they were like kind of little jokey scenes.
Yeah, Thomas, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, in this movie, I never really understand how Harry and Peter are best friends.
I get the backstory,
but like the way they present Harry, he's always sort of sulking about being rich or something, and his dad hates him, which I guess is a problem.
That's always funny.
Yeah.
But that's actually something we haven't talked about yet. What do you guys think of James Franco?
Well, I think he does an excellent job. I just don't think, like, the writing really establishes the relation between him and Peter very well.
Yeah, I agree. It does just kind of, like, assume. I mean, I always got the sense that it's because Harry's sort of an outcast because he's so wealthy, and Peter's an outcast because,
yeah,
he's...
That makes sense.
He's, like, socially retarded. He has no idea how to interact with people at all. Yeah, and so it's like they sort of... I think that's, like, I kind of get that feeling, but yeah, they never really establish it in the movie.
Yeah, and I like James Franco, too. It's sort of interesting, because James Franco is obviously an actor who excels more when he's doing smaller, sort of independent projects.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this very weird blockbuster period in his career where he did these movies and some other big movies. But I think he's pretty good. And he's sort of underserved by the writing in every film. That's something I noted. I don't think they ever quite knew what to do with Harry.
Yeah, like, he doesn't... Yeah, other than, like, Spider-Man 3, he doesn't have, like, feel like he really needs to be that much in the movie.
And in Spider-Man 3, even, there's a lot of weird choices they make.
Yeah.
But the best... Obviously, his best scenes in the series are actually where they... In Spider-Man 3, he gets his mind wiped, and they go back to just him being normal. And that's... It's, like, the end of the series when you find out how they were friends, because they, like, go back in, you know, their relationship and are sort of revisiting that.
Oh, yeah. But
we'll get to that. So, anyway, the next big event in the movie is the Unity Day festival scene. What the fuck is Unity Day?
It's the day where we unify.
Yeah.
Okay. It's like... It's
the day when New York unifies.
It's when Voltron, like all the different lion robots come together and make... It's Unity Day.
Okay. They just couldn't afford to animate Voltron in the scene.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they couldn't afford the rights.
It was happening in the background.
Yeah,
that's
off camera.
They have the balloons.
Yeah, but it's a cool action scene. This is the first big fight between Goblin and Peter, and tons of terrible CGI. Especially best moment is when he throws the bomb and the people descend into skeletons, and it looks like terrible Ray Harryhausen sketches.
Yeah, it's just like. This scene, it's like, rewatching this scene seemed really kind of weird to me. I don't even know why, like, it just, like, I think it's partially because Spider-Man had never really been established of, like, how Spider-Man fights people before up until this point, but I just noticed that it's, like, now he's, like, you don't get the sense of all of a sudden now he's fighting a supervillain, because he'd never really, because he'd only been in montages where he was fighting normal criminals before.
Yeah. And he's still feeling his way out how to do this. And then there's the great kiss-off line where the Goblin's running away and he says,
We'll meet again, Spider-Man!
I love that that's in there and he's like descending into the frame, going back and like flying in circles while he says it. It's awesome.
Just like that is pulled straight from comic book dialogue. That is great. I love that.
And then, of course, they do the full-on Jekyll Hyde scene in Norman's bedroom where he's, like, looking in the mirror. And then you have the scene where he attacks J. Jonah Jameson. And I liked this moment where Jameson doesn't sell out Peter.
Yeah, I love that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, where it's just like, you know that Jameson's not a really bad guy. It's like, he's kind of an asshole, but he's just trying to sell his newspapers.
Right.
And he really thinks that Spider-Man's a menace. Like, he's not just doing that. He's not really just doing that to sell papers. But I do like that you get, like, this little sense that he's protective of the people at the Bugle.
Yes. So that's good. And I guess the next significant scene after all that, which we already talked about, like, the dialogue scene between the Goblin and Spider-Man, which is still one of the weirdest scenes in a major movie I've ever seen, where they both have their masks on, and, like, that Goblin suit looks so awkward in full body shots. Yeah.
And it's really weird because he can't... I don't know if he can't or if he just chose not to, but he doesn't really stand up straight. He sort of, like, kind of crouches his legs a little bit. It's just really, yeah, the whole goblin thing is really weird.
Do you think the goblin's costume in this movie looks good? Because I kind of think it's an abomination.
I don't like it.
No, yeah. It looks terrible, but it's endearingly terrible.
Yeah, it's like, because it, like, but it just fits, it makes sense for how Willem Dafoe plays the goblin. It's like, it seems like he would have this crazy, weird power suit thing that's like just looks really terrible.
Where like it looks like that, like that shouldn't be allowed in a PG-13 movie because it looks like it's a naked suit. See, it's, but it's
Like the thing I always wonder is like I get because they kind of established the power suit thing a bit like when they were at Osborne, like the glider. It's like where did he get the helmet? Like did he ask someone to design that for him at Oscorp? Like does he is he like a secretly does he like a designer and know how to operate the machinery to create his own little like metal helmet thing that goes perfectly with his power suit. Yeah. It's like that looks like a goblin.
Yeah. So the next big scene after that, though, is the most iconic scene in the movie, which is the rain, mugging, and then upside-down kiss sequence with mm-hmm. Peter and Mary Jane. And, you know, watching that again, you understand immediately why it became so iconic, because Raimi is just really good at manipulating you in that scene.
Yeah.
And, like, just every beat of that scene plays perfectly with them having their conversation. Then she goes off. She's getting mugged. Danny Elfman is in the background doing his little, you know, like, really scary musical cues. And then,
I like the way you say that. It sounds like he's, like, hiding behind the trash cans or something.
That's what it sounds like. It's just
the whole orchestra just...
Yeah. Well, that's what it sounds like. It's like, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Mm-hmm. That's what they're doing, and it's great. And then, you know, Spidey comes in to save the day, but he doesn't have his mask on. He jumps up. They do the upside-down kiss. Somehow she doesn't figure out that's Peter Parker.
But, it's like, and I was just like, what the fuck with MJ? She's like, she's dating Harry at that point, and then she just kisses Spider-Man. It's like, well, that's kind of weird.
But like, it always like gets the romantic in me, like, yeah, that's such a great scene. But it, I mean, it is. It's a really well done scene. It's been copied millions of times at this point, it feels mm-hmm. like. It's just parodied everywhere, but even in these movies. So it's really, yeah, that's interesting. And, so then you've got the fire scene where the goblin attacks Peter in the fire, which I've always, again, lots of nice cheesy dialogue. That's actually where I noticed the dialogue being the most clunky, where he's like, I'll never join you, we'll see.
Yeah, and it's just like, although I did love that, I love that Gobby's like in like, he's got like that old like the like shawl or whatever like over his head. It's like, I love that whole, I just love that that's the Green Goblin's plan. He's just going to start a fire and then hide there with, like, this, like, weird, like, modulated scream with, like, a shawl over his head and try to trick Spidey.
Like, he doesn't look like a human when he's wearing that thing, though. Yeah. The back of his helmet.
Yeah, it's like, sticks, like, yeah, it looks, I mean, it looks like he's, like, an alien from Alien. Yeah. Like, wearing a blanket or something.
Yes. But then, here's a moment in the movie that I really don't like, that they never return to, is the people turning against Spider-Man. I don't know really how it was supposed to have happened, but then everyone is mad at him, and then they never reference it again in the series. It's just like, I know that's a thing in the comics, but it's like they're just sort of paying lip service to it, but there's no real like build-up to it or build-off of it.
It's because everyone just believes exactly what the Daily Bugle says in the newspaper, I guess.
Yeah.
Hero or menace.
And the police in this universe are obviously very incompetent.
Oh, and then we've got the great scene where Norman attacks Aunt May while she's saying the Lord's Prayer. And
finish it! Finish it! For me! Yeah, that whole scene is just...
Thomas and I were talking about when we watched it. Thomas and I were talking about, was he just waiting outside listening? And he's like, oh, that's my cue!
Yeah, it's like, just that scene seems like it's from another movie. Like, it's so out of place. It's so bizarre.
And they're taking, like, everyone's, you know, like, Aunt May, who everyone loves at this point, and she's, like, you're on the floor writhing in pain. And
those eyes! Those horrible yellow eyes! Like, that whole, yeah, that whole sequence is, like, that's really, really bizarre. It's so, so ridiculously overdramatic compared to everything else.
Yes. And then there's, of course, she's in the hospital and has the, you're not Superman, you know, line that was in every fucking TV spot for, like, a year.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the times, though, when we were thinking, maybe she secretly actually knows he's Spider-Man.
I've always,
there are kind of hints throughout. Of that, you know? Mm-hmm.
You have to read it. It's much stronger in Spider-Man 2. Yeah. But, mm-hmm. yeah. That would always be funny if she had just like randomly figured it out. But okay, then after that we jump into I forget how fast this movie moves along, because yeah. after that you move into the final fight,
yeah.
the bridge, and then that moves into the scene at the sort of abandoned building. But let's talk about the bridge scene. Sean, you want to talk about the comic origins of this, because it's somewhat different.
Well, yeah, in the comic books, obviously Gwen Stacy was Spider-Man's sort of, or Peter Parker's girlfriend, and like sort of like his true love at that point. Like they had been dating like forever in the comic books. And there was, like, a little bit of a love triangle. Like, MJ was a character at this point, but it was, like, they weren't really together. But, yeah, the Green Goblin, Norman Osborn, kidnaps Gwen Stacy because he figures out that Peter Parker's Spider-Man. And Peter Parker, you know, he races over to the bridge, and the Green Goblin's holding Gwen Stacy over. She's unconscious, and he drops her. Spider-Man jumps after her and, like, tries to save her, but she dies. And that's, like, sort of, And then, like, the comic books have to deal with that aftermath forever. It's, like, this really, really big, dramatic moment. It was the biggest, like, death in comic books, I feel like, up to that point. Like, it really hit hard. It's a really great sequence of stories.
So here's my question. We all know how this scene plays out. It's another iconic action moment. Yeah. And it's pretty cool how he rescues everyone. It's a really great scene, I think. But do you think, I mean, we all love Mary Jane, we all love Kirsten Dunst in this role, do you think it would have been more powerful if they would have had her die there? Or do you think it's better that
It wouldn't have worked if, I mean, I guess it would have been powerful, maybe, but they couldn't kill off MJ. If they had established Gwen Stacy, if they had done Gwen Stacy, yes, then she would have had to have died.
Yeah.
MJ, no, I don't think they should have killed her off.
Well, do you think that's why they didn't do Gwen Stacy?
Because they didn't want to have to deal with that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because MJ is a lot more famous than Gwen Stacy, because, I mean, after that, Peter gets together with MJ, and then, like, they have their... They're together, and they get married until Peter makes a deal with the devil and sacrifices their marriage to save
Well, and what I was going to say is, in many ways, MJ does, though, in these movies, sort of an amalgamation of the two characters.
Yeah, she's not actually almost at all like MJ in the...
Yeah.
comic books.
She seems to err much more on the Gwen Stacy side, where they've always known each other, they've always been friends, sort of.
Yeah, although one of the really interesting things is that when they have that scene where Peter's talking to MJ in the hospital, and he's sort of like, yeah, he's talking through Spider-Man, saying it's like, oh, Spider-Man told me this, or I was telling Spider-Man this about you, and he says like all this stuff is like, oh, you make someone feel strong and weak at the same time, or whatever. It felt like that dialogue actually, it seemed really corny and cheesy to me. And it didn't really feel like it fit with how MJ was established in that movie, but it really sounded like how you would almost describe Mary Jane in the comic book version of Mary Jane, because she's really sort of hot-headed and feisty, and like she's a really strong character. And this, she's very much the girl next door type character, where you know they're childhood friends. He's too timid to talk to her, and she's outgoing, but she's not like, you know, a party animal.
She's not, you hit the jackpot, Tiger.
Yeah, it's like, whenever she calls Peter Tiger in this, it's like, it doesn't feel quite right to me.
Well,
even though they have to do that, but...
I think, but she doesn't do it much, and I think they really...
Yeah, they do it only, like, a little bit.
They save the big Tiger moment for the end of movie 2, and that really hits me. I love when they do it there, but, because that, they've earned it at that point. But yeah, no, I agree. I think, I'm glad they... Again, I think in this movie, you can't have two major character deaths in the same movie, especially because this movie is all about Uncle Ben's death.
It's like, Jesus, it's like, Spider-Man 2 would have been a really different movie if they had killed off MJ.
Well, here's my...
That would have been traumatizing as shit.
Amazing Spider-Man, the new movie, has Gwen Stacy.
Amazing Spider-Man.
And it looks like they're sticking pretty close to who Gwen is.
Yeah.
And they've got Emma Stone, great actress, so that should be pretty interesting. If they're planning another trilogy, and they sort of follow the pattern where movie 2 has to be darker, that should be the ending to movie 2.
Yeah, well, they have to, if they have Gwen Stacy, they have to kill her off.
At some point. And they could do it, if they have two full movies... It could be really powerful.
Why could they not kill Gwen Stacy in movie 3, though?
Because if you're following a three-act sort of structure, you would do that at the end of act 2. It's like Empire Strikes Back.
I mean, in these movies, when they introduced her, why didn't they just kill her?
You mean fake Gwen Stacy?
Howard.
I will give you my rant on fake fucking bitch Gwen Stacy when we get to that stupid fucking movie. God, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I agree. They should have...
killed her.
Yeah, I mean, they had, like, the fake, like, goblin that Harry was playing, so they could have, redone it.
But, like, he wouldn't have tried to save her. He would have been like, oh, okay, let me save these people. And, you know, he fishes her body.
Now, that's another thing. They added in the Goblin never throws off the big group of people in the comic books yet.
But I like that. And it sort of, and then of course we get into the final fight in the warehouse or wherever they are.
Yeah.
And I love that scene because it is brutal.
Yeah, it's really brutal.
And it's really well done. There's no CGI. There's probably CGI, but it just looks very real. There's no music. It's just sound effects. And it really works because they have to get into the brutality of the life Peter's leading.
Yeah.
And sort of the pain of what he has to do in defeating Norman Osborn. And that, again, has ripple effects throughout the trilogy. Really good stuff.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's the big awesome moment where he says, you know, I had a father. His name was Ben Parker. That's awesome. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty good stuff. And then
you end the movie. Gabby impales himself.
Yep. And, again, Willem Dafoe, determined to be as weird as he can, has to go, oh! It's great.
Oh.
Pretty good. And then I think the ending of the movie and sort of the whole arc of this movie, and this is why I really like the movie, is they have a really clear character arc.
Yeah.
Where he's not just learning to be Spider-Man, but how he has to live as Peter Parker now. Yeah. And that they end the movie with him walking away as Peter Parker, not as Spider-Man.
Yeah.
It's that he's had to make these choices as the human, not the superhero.
And he decides that he can't be with MJ because it would put her at risk. Yeah.
And again, that's a scene that, again, they've done in so many superhero movies now, and it's such a cliche.
Yeah.
But it's the movie has earned it at that point so well, and Maguire and Dunst are so good in that scene. And here's another great thing. I think we're going to talk about this much more in Spider-Man 2, because I think it's more important there. But they build up Mary Jane enough as a character, and they give Kirsten Dunst enough to do, that it doesn't, you feel bad for her in that moment just as much as you do for Peter.
Yeah.
It's not just that he's being deprived, it's that he's hurting someone.
Yeah.
And that her hurt is palpable, and when she's mad at him in Spider-Man 2, you're not like, oh, why doesn't she understand? It's, I feel bad for this person. From her perspective, Peter's an awful guy at this point.
Yeah.
You know? So, that's Spider-Man 1.
It's the old Parker luck.
Yep. Anything else to say about Spider-Man 1?
Thomas? Want to add something?
No. You just ended the movie. What could I even say if I wanted
Let's talk about Danny Elfman's score.
Okay.
Which is amazing.
It's brilliant.
Yeah. Danny Elfman is one of the most sort of scattershot composers out there. He can write terrible music and he can write really good music. And I think this is the Spider-Man 1 and 2 scores. He didn't do 3, which is a problem with 3. His music in 3 is bad. Anyway, in Spider-Man 1 and 2, that's his best work of the last decade, at least. It's like the big, iconic superhero score.
Well,
and it's such a great theme he's come up with, not just for Spider-Man, but for Peter and for MJ and for all these elements.
I think the whole tragic theme he sort of has going throughout, well, definitely the first two movies. It's in the third, but it sucks in the third because someone has but it's like Peter's theme and how sad he is. It really expresses that a lot. And it really, to me, it speaks a lot with Tobey Maguire's acting.
Yeah.
The acting and the music in these movies sort of really work well together.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I also like how it doesn't, at least to me, it doesn't feel like it's really cliche superhero music. You know, it's not like the Superman theme. It's like you listen to that and you can tell that's Spider-Man. It's like it's got that, he uses a lot of strings, and it's like, it feels like, especially, I love the moment in Spider-Man 1 where he's learning how to climb the wall, and they do the music stings every time he's climbing up, and the music sort of builds up as he's learning his powers.
And it's sort of interesting to me, it's always been said, and this is why Danny Elfman isn't in 3, that he and Sam Raimi hated each other, and they had trouble working together. And I think that may be why the music is so good, is that it was a contentious working atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Danny Elfman, now all he does is score Tim Burton movies. And obviously those two are best friends, and they're comfortable together, and I don't think he does very good work with Tim Burton anymore. And he's not challenged. And this was a challenge. You're scoring Spider-Man. You're trying to come up with the John Williams equivalent for this iconic character. And he does it, and it's really good. And in all three movies, when you start the opening credits and you're building up to the big Spider-Man theme, it just really gets you going. It gets the blood pumping. It's awesome. So let's talk about Spider-Man 2.
Spider-Man 2.
There's immediate improvement in this movie, right off the bat, with the opening credits, which I love, where they've got all the almost watercolor-esque paintings of the events from movie 1. Yeah. That's cool.
It is.
Yes, it is.
And then,
correct, sir.
We all agree.
And then, the opening scene, which I think is such an interesting and unexpected way to open the movie, of Peter has to deliver pizzas as Spider-Man.
That's another one of those famous guys.
Yeah, it's Asif Manvi.
I mean, he's famous, but he's on The Daily Show.
Yeah, it's Asif Manvi before he became a Daily Show correspondent.
Yeah.
Which is
yeah.
It's funny now.
Yeah. We'll get to more of that. What do you think of the pizza scene, Sean?
I like that. I like all that stuff where they sort of have to establish that Peter's needs to make his own money and he has to make a living, because that's another really big part of
Spider-Man. They spend a solid half hour in this movie just beating Peter into submission, and they make you feel his pain. But again, I think we want to back out for a moment. So Spider-Man 2, overall thoughts, we all love this movie, right?
Yeah.
It's an A-plus movie. It's great.
A super plus.
Yes. One of the best superhero movies of all time, if not the best.
Yes.
Yes. So, and I think part of that is that, again, there's a lot of humor and fun to it, but they were willing to go dark with the tragedy of the character, like you were talking about, and treat it really seriously and just make it a really great sort of drama.
Yeah, and it's just like, it adapts. I mean, there's so much stuff that I love about this movie, because it uses my favorite Spider-Man villain, Doc Ock, and they do him really well in this movie. And then they also adapt a really great Spider-Man comic book story, Spider-Man No More, where that's really the whole arc of the movie is him.
Yes.
Now that he is Spider-Man, now that he's established himself as Spider-Man since the first movie, it's like, how does he deal with that with his life? Because Spider-Man makes his life terrible, but he can't really just get away from it.
Yeah. And I think this is a movie we've talked about before, and I think people are probably the most intimately familiar with is Spider-Man 2. Just because it is the most critically
They're
famous.
They're intimately familiar with Spider-Man 2.
Yes,
Jonathan is.
No, I love this movie, and this is honestly one of my favorite movies. Sean and I, last week on the podcast, or the last 2 weeks, we counted down our 10 favorite movies of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Spider-Man 2 was definitely in contention for that number 10 spot on my list.
Yeah, I agree. Mine too.
I love it. And it's a movie that holds a special place in my heart, because it was the first movie I ever reviewed as a critic. And so that was sort of a start of like a really significant phase in my life, and sort of the kickoff of what I consider my career and my main interests. And I always remember that. And Thomas and I kind of have a funny story to share about that. So we went to the press screening of Spider-Man 2. They had the press seats way in the back.
Yeah, what year was this?
This is 2004.
2004, okay.
So
still only has 1-2. The 2-0s and 1-4.
Yes.
But never mind.
They had these seats in the back, and we were seated next to this elderly couple who were surprisingly into Spider-Man. And then
it was Uncle Ben, not May.
Yes. And then this like 20-year-old guy sitting in front of us, probably like a
Flash
college
Thompson.
Student.
He was behind us.
Oh, he was behind us? Yeah. No, we were in the back row. He was right in front of us. And
was he behind you, or was he in front of you?
And he was...
Will we ever find out?
He was kind of almost frighteningly enthusiastic, and he
kept
talking
about... Yeah, it was Flash Thompson.
Yeah, he kept talking about how awesome Doc Ock was and how excited he was to see him in this movie. He's like, because Doc Ock... I'm going to have to do some miming here that you won't hear on the podcast, I guess, but he would say, like... He's like, Doc Ock's awesome. He, like, did this and went whoosh! And what I'm miming is that this guy would raise his arms and, like, just start moving them back and forth and making the sound whoosh!
But then he also made that other sound. He was like...
Yeah,
it made like a lizard sound too. It was so weird.
Yes,
and
this guy freaked us out.
Yeah, we were both kids at the time.
Yeah,
so.
He shut up before the movie started. But
yeah, no, he was respectful.
Yes,
you could tell he liked Spider-Man. Just
he wasn't going to ruin the movie.
He really liked Spider-Man.
Yes, but great movie. I'll always remember seeing that for the first time and just being floored from moment one to the end. And I still am. It's never depreciated in how much I like it. It's a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, the more deeper I sort of dive into it, I appreciate the craft and sort of assembly of it. It's just really good. But how do we want to take this discussion? I don't think we're... Like I said, people are familiar with this one. I don't want to go quite as, scene by scene in depth. But let's start with the villain, so we can, like, do the villain, then maybe come back and talk about Peter's arc. But Alfred Molina, Dr. Octopus...
Otto Octavius.
Sean, go. Because you know more about Doc Ock, and what do you think about this portrayal?
Whereas Willem Dafoe in Spider-Man 1 as Green Goblin was really off the wall, and I mean... There were elements of the Green Goblin character to him, but it wasn't quite the same thing. Like, they threw a lot of really crazy stuff in with it. Whereas Dr. Octopus, I think they captured that character better than most comic books are actually able to. Where he's just like a really interesting character because he's so much like Peter in the sense that he has all those interests in science. He's a really brilliant scientist, and Peter really respects him in that regard, but he also sort of goes insane. And then he also has, like, the coolest... supervillain, like, fighting stuff with his, like, four arms. That's, like, it seems like such a simple idea, but it's, like, it's such a cool element.
And it's grounded in a certain semblance of reality.
Yeah, it makes more sense than, like...
The Green Goblin.
Yeah, than Green Goblin, like Captain America Super Soldier Serum.
Yeah.
Or Spider-Man getting bitten by either radioactive spider or genetically modified spider.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the harness hooked up to his nervous system actually kind of makes sense. Could theoretically maybe work.
In comparison, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, in comparison, it makes a hell of a lot more sense.
Yeah.
And Alfred Molina... So the first scene with Alfred Molina is, again, I like that they keep it on Peter's point of view where he's going to just talk to him about a project. And there's that great scene where they're just sort of hanging out and talking about science together. And Alfred Molina is so fun in these scenes and sets up that character so well where you really care about the guy.
Yeah. And they do something interesting. I don't know if in the comic books I've never seen him have a wife. But they did. They built that. I thought that was a really interesting character dynamic for him where they built a really nice relationship with him and his wife in this movie, and then obviously when she dies, like it serves as a catalyst for his character, where it didn't really have something like that in the comic books.
Yes, and I think, in some sense, I think you're supposed to see mirrored in that. This is like who Peter and MJ 20, 30 years from now could be.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of this, you know, really healthy couple who love each other and have their own different strengths as like people and their own sets of intelligence and stuff.
Yeah.
And Peter sort of sees in them the normal life he wants, and it sort of contributes to his own sense of longing back in his story. But then you have that tragedy, so Peter at all times really does sympathize with Doc Ock. He doesn't want to hurt this guy.
Yeah.
He wants to help him if he can, but he never really gets the chance to.
They make Doc Ock a lot more tragic in this movie than he usually is in the comic books, which I think works. They make him almost more like the Lizard in a way.
Yeah.
Where it's like, yeah, he has this very sort of father-son relationship with the character, and he understands the character as he was as a human before he turns into the supervillain.
And I think that's why I'm kind of glad they never got to Spider-Man 4 and did the Lizard, because it would have felt a little repetitive if they'd done it exactly the same, you know. But, yeah, Doc Ock's really good. There's a lot of good fight sequences with them.
Yeah, because Doc Ock's awesome.
And, oh, the scene I really want to talk about is after the transformation scene where, you know, he becomes Doc Ock, is the hospital room scene where he awakens as Doc Ock.
Yeah, Jesus.
That is Sam Raimi in full-on horror mode.
Yeah.
Not holding anything back and just having as much fun as possible.
That's really...
Especially when he wakes up.
Dark scene.
Yeah.
After the arms, go kill everyone. Then he
are you going to continue the
sentence? The arms go kill everyone.
That's all I was going to say. Arms go kill everyone.
No, what were you going to say, Thomas?
I don't know.
Okay. Anyway, but let's talk about the arms killing anyone, because that's the scene we're talking about. It's just like... I love it. The docs are being stupid assholes.
Yeah.
And there's no music whatsoever. Just these simple little sounds. Like, there's these little string movements.
Yeah.
And then, shit goes goes wild.
Yeah.
And they're lifting things up, and, like, the guy's reaching for the chainsaw, and the woman is, like, scratching off steel from the floor and screaming her lungs out. And they're, like, he's throwing people across the room, and you see Alfred Molina's, like, face in the, like, just lying there going, like, moving a little bit to show that he's, like, controlling the arms a little bit, or if they're controlling him or whatever. And it's so wonderfully violent.
Yeah, it's just, like, so dark and gruesome. In, like, what was otherwise a really fun sort of, like, movie.
Well, then he wakes up and it's the really cheesy...
I really like that they gave the arms, like, a sort of a personality in the movie. I've seen that sometimes in the comic books, though. I'm not sure if I've ever seen that done before the movie.
Yeah.
Because they did do a thing where he established a psychic connection with the arms and he was able to move it after they were moved. That's the whole thing. So I guess they kind of did do that, but it's like it was never quite done in that way. And it's like, and they gave, he has this thing where it's like, and they sort of like scream with him somehow, even though they shouldn't be able to do that.
But what do you think of the action scenes? There's the big bank robbery, and then there's the big train scene, and then there's the final fight.
The train scene is freaking awesome.
Yeah,
the train scene's awesome. I also love, the whole, there's like a really long moment where they're, it's the bank robbery scene, and they're sort of like falling through the air and fighting each other. That whole sequence is so cool.
It is.
Like, and all that, just like, they just do Doc Ock so well with like his powers and those action scenes where you like, to get the sense of like how he would use the arms and stuff. There's like, they just, whereas with Green Goblin, there's like, Green Goblin either punches you or he throws bombs at you. Yeah. It's like Doc Ock has the whole thing with his arms, and he's a really intelligent character and all that stuff. Like, it really gives you a sense of how the character would fight, and it's a really interesting fight scene. It's not like just a normal fight scene you would see in like any other movie.
You know, in that scene, there's the part where Spider-Man is slinging at him and he pulls the knife out of one of his arms.
Yeah.
Why did he put that there if they were built for science?
I mean, he might have had to...
He needed an impalement knife?
Yeah, he might have had to skewer something. In case, you don't know.
He was eating a pig or something while doing science.
Like he's having a luau in the...
Yeah, well, I don't... I'm just trying to...
He could.
I mean, what if he was, like, you know, he was doing his whole, like, fusion reactor experiment, and then it, like, opened a black hole, and, like, a xenomorph or an alien or something came out, and he had to stab it to death.
So he was more worried about stabbing the alien to death than closing the black hole.
Well, I mean... Well,
how are you going to do that?
Yeah, how is he going to close a black hole? It's like, shit's gone down, you need to kill all the aliens you can, and then get out before you get sucked into the Event Horizon. So...
He's also making a sun, which is interesting.
Yeah. The power of the sun in the palm of my hand.
Well, that's what I was going to say next, is I think one of the reasons why Doc Ock is the perfect choice for this particular movie and story they're telling is that this movie is much more about Peter. It's not about Spider-Man as much as it is just about Peter going about his life and going through personal crises. And you have to have a villain who's not going to be in there omnipresently. And so Doc Ock, he's not out for world domination or anything. He's just trying to repeat his experiment. So you can have him off in the background doing his own thing for long stretches of time, and it doesn't feel like they've forgotten about him. It's just he's doing something else, and he doesn't need to be terrorizing the city. And, you know, I think if you had the Green Goblin in there, if you had plenty of other characters, I mean, most of the Spider-Man mega-villains are really out for domination and things like that, or bigger events, but he's more of a personal villain. He's working for his own personal goals. And so it's...
He's just trying to do science!
Yes. So you can leave him out of it for a while, and that works. And I think that's where we need to transition into our discussion of Peter's story. There's just so much that happens, and every scene in it is so good. But they really do... the first act of the movie, I guess you would call it, maybe first act and a half, of just Peter's life going to hell and everything going wrong.
Like when the backpacks are hitting him.
Yes.
He's at college and he drops his stuff and... Everyone in the world hates Peter again.
It's like, they just kind of walk over him.
Yeah. But really good stuff. They've got a lot of great montages, I think. Sam Raimi makes good use of sort of pop music in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's the montage where he's going to try to go to the play, and then, of course, everything goes to hell. And that's where you get Mr. Bruce Campbell as the rude doorman.
Which, this is my favorite of the Bruce Campbell cameos, I think.
Oh, yeah, easily.
Yeah. It's Bruce Campbell being an asshole to Peter for, like, no reason whatsoever. He's just a complete jackass.
And, but it does go with my, like, theory of, like, he's Peter's spiritual guide. Because, like, let's say this version of Bruce Campbell can see all points in time and space. And he knows what Spider-Man must do to become the hero he's born to be. And he must miss the play and go back out into the world and have this life lesson. And abandon his, costume and then come back to it later. And that's why he's there at the door rejecting him. And then he's also just being a dick because, the angels are dicks, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. Anything to add, Thomas? You want to comment on this?
No.
Grand unified Bruce Campbell theory?
I don't think... I don't know. Sure.
The G-U-B-C-T. Anyway.
That could be the name of the podcast.
The Grand Unified Bruce Campbell Theory Podcast?
Yeah.
You could probably talk about that for a couple episodes.
Yeah.
Evil Dead Reviews. No. Anyway, so there's that scene and everything. But and then there's also the big scene, which I really like, at the ball, the gala, where for J. Jonah Jameson's son.
Yeah, John Jameson.
And that's one where I want to highlight what the work Kirsten Dunst does in this movie, because I think it's pretty amazing. It's some really good stuff here with her character and sort of dealing with her own angst about, you know, what Peter has become and what he's doing and how she feels bad about it, but still, you know, she needs to move on with her life, so she's with this astronaut. And I like that they don't go the typical route of making the astronaut character just a dick who we're supposed to hate. He's a nice guy. She could have a good life with him, and we're not supposed to be mad at him or her or anything. It's a movie that really understands every point of view.
Yeah, I always find it kind of interesting that, they throw John Jameson in there, as, like, he's, like, and he doesn't have a lot of screen time. He has, like, does he only have, like, one scene where he's really talking to MJ, like, during the apartment?
Yeah.
And, like, but it's interesting because John Jameson, he's an astronaut, and he also is a werewolf in the comic books. So I'm sad that they never got to do, like, there's so many possibilities that the Sam Raimi movies had continued on to, like, you know, getting to, like, their, like, 10th version, where they would just have nothing left to do, and they would just throw in, like, werewolf John Jameson or something as the villain.
And J. Jonah Jameson is a big part of it, where he's, like, grieving for his son.
Yeah.
He's become a werewolf, and,
So many missed opportunities.
Yes. No, Kirsten Dunst does a lot of really great dramatic work in this movie. In many ways, she grounds it because you have to understand her as the point of Peter's affections and how his heart is kind of broken. But you also, like I said earlier, have to understand her point of view on it. And I think you never, I at least as a viewer, never get mad at her for being mad at Peter. I always understand it.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really well-rounded character. Even when, you know, she's getting kidnapped every 5 minutes, it's...
Princess Peach style.
Yep. Really good. There's a lot of great scenes. I mean, there's the iconic scene in the cafe near the end of the movie where she's asking, you know, if he loves her, and then the
car... And then Doc Ock just chucks a fucking car at them.
Which, great scene.
Yeah.
But really well-paced, good acting on her part. Lots of stuff I like there. And the other thing I kind of wanted to note is, so she's in the play Importance of Being Earnest, and I think you have two scenes watching her in that play. Kirsten Dunst did at least three movies set in, like, that period after that. Like, that was like her audition reel for Marie Antoinette and all these other period pieces she started doing. And I've always found that kind of funny going back to this. Because she, like, seems really natural at that.
Yeah.
And it's a really weird moment. You'll cut from Mary Jane, you know, sort of talking with Peter, and then she's playing this very, you know, non-modern character. It's like, she's really good at that. Like, she found her niche, I guess. But it's really interesting.
Yeah.
So you've got those, that character, and let's talk about sort of the stuff that gets Peter to abandon the costume. And I think they earn that really well.
Yeah.
And there's that great scene where he's hollow sort of talking to Uncle Ben in his dream. And sort of tearfully saying, I can't do this. And just, again, Tobey Maguire being so good, that being, to me, an Oscar-worthy moment of him, you know, just finally admitting to himself, I don't know if I can be the responsible man you want me to be.
Yeah.
And Uncle Ben being so sad and disappointed, but still sort of understanding. Really great stuff.
Yeah, they just did because, like, that's what was so tragic about it to me is that, yeah, he has to, Peter is, like, shouldn't be the kind of person that has to do this. He's a science nerd.
Yeah.
And he's not, I mean, that's like in the comic books, he's never trained, he doesn't know how to actually fight people. It's like he just does what he does because he has this really strong sense of responsibility because of what happened to Ben. But it's like, by all rights, he shouldn't be doing any of this stuff at all. But yeah, they get that character beat down so well where he just finally realizes, I can't do this and I don't want to do this anymore. It's like, I want to live my life. I want to just kind of be normal. I don't want to be a superhero because I shouldn't be a superhero, really.
Right. And they're not afraid after that when, you know, they recreate the great iconic shot of him leaving it in the Spider-Man costume in the trash, of saying, life is better this way.
Look at it. Yeah, yeah, like, that's a really tragic thing, is that, yeah, Peter's life gets really good. That, yeah, he's really happy, everything's going well for him.
The raindrops keep falling on my head montage, love it, great use of music. Yeah, I love
that. It's like, all that stuff where they really build out. It's like, he can be with Mary Jane. He can have what he wants. He can, you know, be there for his family. He can be there for the people he care about. And he can just live the life he wants to live. He can be there at school and learn stuff and be a science nerd. But the really tragic thing about Spider-Man is that he can't let himself have that life, even though he would be really, really happy. And and that is the life he wants to have. He can't shirk his overwhelming sense of responsibility, ultimately.
And I think that's why I've always sort of felt, even though there are things I like about Spider-Man 3, I wish this had been a two-movie series. And that's because the point they ended at feels like that's where you need to end this story in a certain sense, because that's an arc conclusion that feels really powerful to me, of him seeing this other side of life he can have. And then, just as you said, the tragedy, knowing he can't have it.
Yeah, that he can't let himself have it.
And so he can't let himself have it. He saves Mary Jane. He, you know, Doc Ock sacrifices himself. We'll talk about all that in a little bit. But then, you know, he's sitting alone in his room, and he's happy in a sense because he knows he's made the choice that will make him feel fulfilled, but not the choice that will make him happy, you know? And then Mary Jane comes and says, we can try this. We can be together. And he leaves to go fight. And she's standing there, and they end the movie on the shot of her looking out. You know, she says, go get him, Tiger. Yeah. Great moment. He goes out, and then it just ends on the shot of her looking out, sort of melancholy, and knowing that this is going to be tough. And that's what I like, is they're accepting the realities of this, that in each other they can find sort of a modicum of happiness, something that will keep them sane, but it's not going to solve everything. And that's what Spider-Man 2 ends on. And then Spider-Man 3 opens on the suggestion that it did solve everything for them. And that's one of my biggest problems with Spider-Man 3. They make Peter really, really happy for half of that movie. And yeah. it doesn't, that's not right.
And just like, but, and that's what's really great, or what was really great about Mary Jane in the comic books and their relationship with each other, especially when she finds out that Peter's Spider-Man and she still decides to be with him and they get married and they have that, like, that's some of my favorite Spider-Man comic books are after they're married and they have that married life together, because it really changes the dynamics of the comic books, because Peter has something to come back to, and yeah. that's what's really powerful about Mary Jane as a character, is that she can handle all the stress and all the shit that gets thrown into her life because she's with Peter, but she's not just going to throw him to the wolves.
Yeah.
It's like, she almost has, like, they don't really do it that much in this movie, because, I mean, it would make, like, a 3-hour movie, but in the comic book, she has a similar arc to Peter, where she has to, she has to realize that she could probably be more happy if she wasn't with Peter, but she has almost a sense of responsibility, this duty for her love for Peter, to stay with him and be there for him. And she has a very similar
sort yeah. of. And I still get that, though, out of this movie, that she knows it would be easier. She's seen the alternatives. Yeah. And when she finds out who he is,
everything clicks. She could be married to an astronaut.
Yeah, a rich astronaut, probably. Yeah. You know, son of a wealthy bugle owner.
But he's a werewolf.
This is true. But what happened, you know, but then her ultimate decision and everything, it feels like a great sort of non-traditional place to end a series if they had done that. It's such a satisfying ending where it's not the traditional happy ending. It's just happy enough, you know? Yeah. And I feel like that's what Spider-Man to me is about, is finding places in our life where we can be happy enough to go about our lives. Because Spider-Man is always, all of Stanley's work is more about real life than it is about fantasy.
Yeah.
It's about metaphor and stuff. And that's what Spider-Man 2 is it's about that period after high school and when you're trying to figure out what your life is and you don't know what's going to make you happy. And you have to find the things that are going to bring you fulfillment more than anything else.
You also have to fight the mad scientist with a pair of mechanical arms that can.
A pair
like,
is two.
A pair of. A set of four okay. mechanical arms.
Yes. Sorry. Anyway.
A pair of arms.
Speaking yeah. of a pair of arms.
Pair of a pair.
The last sort of big epic action scene with Doc Ock, which is kind of two parts, the train, yeah. and then you have the scene at the aquarium or whatever he's at. It's not an aquarium.
Like
there's
the abandoned
water.
Warehouse?
Yeah,
on the docks?
It's on water, so.
Well, that's because they're on the docks. Like, okay. Just because there's water doesn't mean it's an aquarium.
How awesome is that train sequence?
So, I mean, an aquarium has to have fish. That's Wait. What makes it an aquarium.
The fish aren't on the train.
No, I'm trying to say
there
it
aren't any fish.
Into it.
That's what I'm saying. It's not an aquarium. There are no fish.
Why are we talking about the trains then?
Because
there's
the
no
train,
water on the train.
After the train yeah. scene, they go to the water scene. So I'm just setting
it's
up where we are.
It's
in
a warehouse on the docks.
Okay.
There is some water, yes, because they're on the docks, but
and
it's not
raining.
The water
I think
scene.
It's raining.
It's kind of a water scene. He has to
it's
pull
really
it into
not,
the river.
That's the very, very end of that scene.
Yeah, most of the scene just takes place in an abandoned warehouse.
Then can
on
we
the
stop
docks.
Talking about that and talk about the train action sequence, which is awesome?
Okay, fine.
What do you think of the train scene?
I think it's awesome. It's an awesome action sequence. I love. I also just love all the. Like, they really. It kind of reminds me of some of the stuff in the comic books where, like, Spider-Man's always, like, sort of pushing the limits of his strength, and he has a thing where he's, like, trying yeah. to hold it back, and he, like, shoots all the web.
And they make a really good decision there to take the mask off, so you yeah. can have Tobey Maguire really emoting there what he's doing. Uh-huh. And I think it emphasizes what we were talking about before with tragedy of how much he puts himself through for people he doesn't even know, but he's willing to die for these people.
Yeah.
You know, this is his duty. He will die if he has to in this moment. And it's really powerful. And then, of course, you know, Doc Ock takes him, and then there's the... We haven't talked about Harry's arc in this movie. Harry is in a holding pattern in this film, where he's
yeah.
just... His arc doesn't really resume until film 3.
Yeah.
He's just mad this whole movie. And then, of course, you know, he wimps out when he's about to kill Peter, and,
yeah.
and Peter leaves and goes and rescues MJ. But I really love how they do the final scene at the warehouse, where Mary Jane finds out. There's a lot of great imagery there with
yeah.
this red color scheme and sort of Mary Jane like being sucked into the giant ball of fusion energy. There's lots of great frames in this scene.
Yeah, all the fish in the aquarium.
Yep.
Water, I don't know how water stops fusion.
You want to talk about that?
I don't. I really don't, but
okay.
I'm just saying. I don't.
Yeah.
Like, if you took the sun...
In the palm of your hands.
If you had the whole sun somehow, and you dumped it in a body of water that somehow was bigger than the sun wouldn't stop.
That's true.
Yeah, it would just dissolve all the water. Yeah,
that's not a problem. I'm just saying, I don't know how, like, the river is the solution to, I don't know.
I don't even know how they... Because you would think if you were doing, like, a fusion reactor thing, you'd have, like, a particle accelerator and, like, smash particles together. Because
no,
you
need some metal poles, you know.
You just need... Yeah, I don't even know what he does. It's like... It just zaps, like, yeah, some, like, tritium stuff. And then it... Fusion happens, I guess.
Thomas, you did note some science stuff while we were watching this movie. One, you said tritium. They were actually correct in their analysis of what tritium is and how much there is.
No, they're not.
Oh, they're not? Never mind. Okay. What is it, then? Tritium's not real, or...
I don't... It's not on the table.
Okay.
Unobtainium?
There... Yeah.
That's there, basically what it is.
There are some elements that would be that rare, but they'd be radioactive.
Okay. Then they just decay incredibly fast.
Yeah, they would just decay really fast, so you wouldn't really do much fusion with them.
Then Thomas...
And you wouldn't... No, you couldn't... If anything, any element that was that high on the periodic table of elements would... You wouldn't be able to fuse it. I mean, yeah, I guess no, you could do, like, deuterium or something. Like
maybe, but...
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't understand why you wouldn't just fuse hydrogen. Like, that would be the easiest to do, because it's the light.
It would, but there's also a lot of it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
the science in the movie doesn't make any fucking sense.
Well,
yeah.
Thomas, actually, there is a scene, though, where the science was correct, and Thomas, you wanted to talk about this?
Oh, is this the subwoofer thing?
Yes. So,
the scene where Harry is, Doc Ock is approaching Harry to say he needs more tritium.
And Harry is just standing there, and there's shaking, and he can't figure out where Doc Ock is. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yes.
This is the first time we've watched this movie at home with a subwoofer.
Yeah.
And so I noted, yeah. The cool thing about bass sounds is that you can't tell where they're coming from, so that's why he's looking around, although he probably would have heard, like, breaking windows or something, and that reminded me of this one story that Douglas Adams told at a TED Talk one time, where he was talking about this parrot that lives in Australia, and there are, like, 40 of them left, or they might actually be extinct by this time.
Poor parrots.
Yeah. This one species of parrot, the mating call that the male has is a bass frequency. So if, like, one of the 30 or however many females are left could hear one of the male's mating calls, then it couldn't tell where it's coming from, and it'd be like Harry up on the deck just looking around. Yeah.
Yep. Cool, Thomas.
I'm just like, picturing, like, this parrot. It's got, like, this really deep voice. Like, hey, baby, want to come back to my perch?
This parrot as a Spider-Man villain?
Yeah, it's like, in Australia.
Yes.
You want to
it's probably, I mean, if it's not in Australia, the parrot was probably venomous, too. So
thank you for telling us that, Thomas. It's a fun anecdote.
I'm saying bass frequencies are cool.
Yes, they are. So is Spider-Man. Another thing I wanted to talk about with this one is I love how they use Aunt May again as, again, sort of this steady influence in Peter's life, and she gets to give him the big speech about what a hero means.
Which is, again, suggesting that she kind of knows.
I'll talk about that in a second, but I want to ask you, Sean, you've talked about clunky dialogue before. I think this is another one where if you had a lesser actor or actress delivering it, I don't know if it would work. Because it's a very overt thematic speech, but it always hits me. It's one of my favorite scenes in the movie where she's talking about what heroes mean, and it really starts Peter thinking that he might need to go back to what he does.
Mm-hmm.
And then he recites it to Doc Ock at the end, and that makes Doc Ock, you know, pull the fusion down. Do you like that scene?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it serves as, like, I agree. It's another one of those, like, speeches that in the Spider-Man movies that should be really clunky, but for some reason it works.
Yeah.
And it's like, not entirely sure why.
And I've always, Thomas and I were talking about this the other day when we watched it, is the way she's talking about heroes and how directly her dialogue is exactly what Peter needs to hear in that exact moment.
She was really Bruce Campbell the whole time.
Yes.
I know, that's my theory too.
No, and that she, I don't know, it's just in all the movies, she keeps giving Peter these speeches that he as Spider-Man needs to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm always wondering, does she know and she's just too nice to say anything about it? Like, she knows, she understands he's trying to keep it a secret and she doesn't want to be nosy about it? That's like my conspiracy theory about Aunt May.
I think she's really Bruce Campbell.
That's not a conspiracy.
Yeah, if there's only one person, it can't possibly be a conspiracy.
Okay. No.
Conspiring with Emma Watson.
Well, what's she conspiring? To make Spider-Man a better hero?
Yes.
Oh.
Just kidding.
That's a good conspiracy.
Yeah. But anyway.
Conspiring with herself.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just saying.
Okay. So that's Spider-Man 2. Is there anything else, any other scenes we wanted to talk about that really stand out in this movie?
I always like the scene where Peter abandons the Spider-Man thing and he's trying to get back with MJ and he's trying to talk to her and he says, like, I thought there was something I had to do, but I don't need to do it anymore. Yeah. I've always really liked that scene.
It's really good.
Yeah. It's another one of those speeches that seems like it's kind of like weird dialogue, but for some reason it really works.
Yeah, I mean, again, I can't stress enough how good Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst are together, especially in scenes like that where it's just regular human conversation they're having. And I think there's a lot of naturalism to this movie, where it's heightened, it's superheroes, but there's a lot of it that feels very relatable, like Spider-Man should.
Yeah.
And very down-to-earth. And I think this was obviously sort of the high point for superhero movies until The Avengers, I would say. And and until The Avengers, I think it was also the best third act in a superhero movie, where it's just action after action, but with a lot of emotion behind it.
Yeah.
So, and we just, for the record, don't count The Dark Knight as a superhero movie. It's obviously a great film.
Yeah, but it's not the same, like, it's a different genre. It's like crime thriller more than, like, Spider-Man superhero.
Right. So, lots of great stuff. I have the whole list of people in this movie who later went on to do big things. Emily Deschanel, who is the star of Bones, is the rude receptionist at the beginning who won't give Peter money for pizza. Daniel Day Kim, who is Jin on Lost, is the lab assistant who has one line. We have achieved successful fusion, sir.
I didn't catch that was him.
Yeah, he's not even, I don't even know if he's ever in the foreground. But it's Daniel Day Kim. Elizabeth Banks is Betty Brant again. They're slowly giving her more to do. Joel McHale, the star of Community, is the bank guy they're talking to.
Like the asshole bank
guy. Yeah. Which is great, because Community is one of Thomas and mine's favorite shows, and we had not watched this movie since Community went on the air, so we went back to it with a totally new point of view on that scene, because it's, you know, Joel McHale from Community. And then Asif Manvi in the beginning of the movie. So, I just thought that was interesting. The Spider-Man movies were sort of a breeding ground for future, like, TV stars.
Or it could have been just, like, a complete coincidence.
Yeah. Anyway, let's talk about Spider-Man
3. Spider-Man the third.
All right, so Spider-Man 3. It's sort of hard to know where to start with this movie because it's obviously got its own legacy behind it that you need to address when you're going to talk about the movie, in that it is a very reviled movie. My own thoughts on Spider-Man 3 have definitely evolved since I first saw it, and we're going to talk about all that, but Spider-Man 3 has grown to be sort of reviled as, like, one of the worst movies of all time and stuff. And no matter how many problems I have with the movie, that is out of line.
Yeah.
It is not a terrible movie. If you think Spider-Man 3 is a terrible movie, you've never seen a real terrible movie.
Yeah.
I mean, this movie is competently shot, well acted, it's coherent. Mm-hmm. There's lots of things that are redeemable about Spider-Man 3.
The action's good.
Great action choreography. It's not a terrible movie, and it's by no means as bad as people still try to make out that it is, I don't think.
Yeah. That being said,
I don't like it.
No.
Yeah. It's like I said, like I was going to rewatch it, and I just didn't really feel like it. Like,
no, and here's and when I talk about my thoughts evolving, and Sean, I think you and I have kind of had a similar evolution on it. When it first came out, 2007, that was like the most excited I'd ever been for a movie, because I loved Spider-Man so much. The trailers were really good for it. It looked great.
They were adapting a really great story arc with the Venom stuff.
The poster. Oh, fuck. I had that poster up in my room for like 5 years. It's a great poster of just him and the symbiote opposite each other. Yeah. And the symbiote suit is such a great design. It looks so cool.
I'm not a huge fan of the redesign.
Okay. All right.
I mean, it makes more sense because it looks like it's something grew over his actual suit.
Anyway. But it looked intimidating and intriguing.
Yeah.
Okay. So, anyway, I was really excited for it. When I first saw it, and each time I saw it in theaters, because I saw it a couple times, I was always like, it's not as good as the others, but I was kind of forcing myself to like it. Did you have that at all?
I wouldn't say I was forced.
Were you more forgiving at the beginning?
I was more forgiving, because I still think it's an okay movie, but it's like, it definitely, compared to the other Spider-Man movies, it has a lot more flaws.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I just remember it not... It just doesn't flow as well, and so it's not really a movie that I just want to go sit and watch.
Yeah, and at this point, I've watched it enough times, and the most recent time we watched it, Thomas and I did this for the podcast, we watched all three in a row, and the third one just, I do not like this movie. I'm at the point where I can finally just kind of definitively say, I don't think it's a terrible movie, it's not a movie I don't know if I ever need to watch it again.
Yeah, that's kind of how I am with this. Like, I don't think it's like a terrible movie, but I don't really just want to watch it.
And I think it's more disappointing than anything else, in that the first two are so good, and then you get to the third, and it's so flawed. Every single minute, you're just feeling missed opportunities and things that just aren't clicking, and all these different elements. And I think it's more that it's got wasted potential, and that's what frustrates me more than anything else, in that 1 and 2 kind of live up to their full potential. You know, when you have Doc Ock, they make the best use of Doc Ock possible. When they have Green Goblin, we can argue about ways they could have adapted the character, but he's fucking memorable. Yeah, they have that. So there's all these things to it, and then just the movie itself, it's not a good continuation of 1 and 2.
Well, they try... I think, honestly, my main problem with it is they put in... so much. Like, they tried to put in all these villains and change the backstory with Uncle Ben and how he died and the symbiote on top of all that.
And then Venom.
Yeah, well, it's just like all the stuff with, like, Mary Jane now. They, like, open that can of story again. Like,
Here's the thing that frustrates me most about Spider-Man 3. So, at its base, it's a movie about Peter having to deal with that he can do bad things too, and he's not better sometimes than the villains he's fighting, and he can learn to empathize with these people. And I think if you had Sandman, this interpretation of Sandman with Thomas Hayden Church, who's quite good, and you had Harry doing his thing as the sort of the Hobgoblin or whatever you want to call him.
Yeah. He wasn't the Hobgoblin.
New Goblin,
that's a completely different character.
Okay.
Completely different.
Yes, fine. However you want to call it. But if you had those two things, and maybe have the symbiote in there too as this sort of arc of him embracing darkness, I think that could work if it were written.
Embrace the darkness.
If the movie had a little more time to play with it and were a little longer. No, not time. If it were better written, is what I'm trying to say.
And didn't have Gwen Stacy.
Yes, and well, there's a ton of unnecessary characters.
And Eddie Brock.
Yeah, there's a ton.
And they didn't need to open up the Mary Jane relationship troubles again.
No, they didn't. But what I'm trying to say is, I think there's a lot of elements here that I think the core of Spider-Man 3 needed to be a crowded movie, because I think there's things about it that need to be about sort of chaos and things like that, especially with the symbiote being introduced. But it's too chaotic, and it's not well written, and there's a lot of problems with it. It feels like they were very rushed to make a release date.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Sam Raimi said as much. No one who's involved with this movie has come out and said they like it. You know, they've admitted to problems with it. And it's one of the problems with, you know, Hollywood's blockbuster machine system is that you have to sacrifice quality for a release date, and that's what they did with this, and that's really too bad.
And for shoehorning in, like, the most popular character you can.
Yeah. And I mean, and again, if Sam Raimi's always said he was forced to do Venom, he didn't want to do Venom. You can have whatever opinion on Venom you want. If Sam Raimi, as the director and author of these films, does not like Venom, he should not do Venom. Because you have to have enthusiasm for what you're doing.
Yeah.
He obviously has none for it. And if he doesn't like Venom, that's okay. That's his opinion. There's lots of Spider-Man villains. I don't particularly like Venom either. In those things I've seen.
You're
wrong, I'm not.
I can respect Sam Raimi's opinion, but that's you just wrong.
Thank you. But I see where he's, I'm just trying to say, there's a lot of things in here that I don't think he wanted to do personally, and you can feel that. Yeah. But, okay, where do you want to start with your discussion of the movie?
Let's do characters.
Yeah, let's do characters. Because that's to me, the biggest problem with the movie is they have too many characters.
Well,
it feels like they tried to make two different movies, really.
Yeah. And I think they also, the existing characters are not done.
Yeah, they messed, like, Peter is an idiot the whole time.
He's acting out of character for so much of this movie. Like, when he goes and does the upside-down kiss with Gwen. And there's... why did he do that?
It's like, I understand it's sort of going to his head, but he still wouldn't do that. That was like...
Again, it's an interesting arc they have where, okay, Peter's finally getting respect for being Spider-Man.
Yeah.
He should react in new ways because he's never felt that before, but he's not going to go cheat on Mary Jane because in front of her. Yeah.
He has some social issues, you know, not understanding things, but he's not stupid.
Yeah, and he wouldn't do that. Yeah. Like, could make some social mistakes. He's not going to make out with Gwen Stacy right in front of MJ when he's about to marry MJ.
Like, the thing, when he doesn't understand MJ's frustration with the critic thing, that sort of makes sense that he would not understand that. But the thing with Gwen, and then later in the restaurant when he tries to propose, and he's just being an ass.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't make any sense.
There's a thing where, though, Thomas, where I can say the line, like, I can understand why he wouldn't understand her frustration, but then his reaction is still insensitive in a way that doesn't make sense. Like, he would do anything for this woman. That's what's been established, and he's just being selfish. Yeah. And then Mary Jane is being stupid, and she's been established as intelligent, and she decides to hide from him that she got fired, and all these other things. It's really weird.
Yeah, if this is one of the... I'm identifying this problem now with Spider-Man, that people feel that like, with Spider-Man's relationship with Mary Jane, or Peter Parker's, that they can't have a stable, happy relationship. It's bullshit. There are lots and lots of good comic books all about Peter Parker and Mary Jane, and they have their stable relationship. All of J. Michael Straczynski's run, right before they destroyed everything, is really fantastic and focuses all on that relationship. But people feel they need to, even after that arc's sort of been established, that they then need to, like, just break it open and do it again, like they did with this movie.
And
Or you just completely delete, like, 50 years of continuity with the devil, and then start over again. Which I'm glad, at least, I will say this about Spider-Man 3, at least it didn't do that. At least Spider-Man didn't make a literal deal with the devil and sacrifice his relationship with Mary Jane. But at least that didn't happen.
But what's frustrating about it is that they don't even... Okay, so they want to break open the relationship in and analyze it in sort of a dysfunctional way.
Yeah.
I don't agree with that choice. I can understand why you make it. But they do it poorly because it's all based on really stupid contrivances.
Yeah, it's like it's not natural. And I think the reason is it wouldn't... I don't think you could do it in a very natural way because the characters... It should have a stable relationship at this point. There's no reason for them to have all this chaos.
They should be allowed to have problems. Like, they should be able to both be jealous of the other's success, but they would talk to each other about it. That's who we've established.
And even then, I wouldn't have... Like, that arc makes no sense that they would be jealous of each other's success. There'd be a lot of strain on the relationship because of Peter being Spider-Man.
Right.
That makes sense. But, like, them being... Her being jealous is like Spider-Man's getting attention and all this. It's like, that doesn't... Mary Jane would never do that.
And Mary Jane, especially as established in these movies...
Yeah, even in, like, neither Mary Jane. This movie's Mary Jane or comic book Mary Jane would never do that.
And it's just... And Kirsten Dunst and Tobey Maguire don't get to be fantastic in this movie because they're given bad material.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, they're very good with what they're given. They elevate it quite highly, I think. Yeah. But there's just a limit to what they can do, especially when Tobey Maguire has to be Disco Peter. And,
emo Peter.
You know who they didn't, in my opinion, mess up as much as Harry.
Let's talk about that. I actually really like how they do Harry.
Harry's fine with this.
I think, like, when he gets his memory erased, I really like that, you know, old, friendly Harry.
One of my favorite scenes in the movie is when MJ, even though it's a contrivance that gets her here, I like when she goes to Harry for support, and they just have a day sort of cooking and having fun together. That's a nice, casual, human scene that the rest of this movie doesn't have.
Yeah.
And James Franco, it's what he's good at. He can really do that. Fun stuff there. And
then they mess it up at the end.
Sort of. And I even like sort of their design. Let's talk about Harry as the new Goblin. Do you guys like him turning into a ninja?
Why does he have a ski mask?
That's an interesting
And what's choice. With, like... He's a skateboarder.
Yeah, he's got like the sky. Like, yeah, I don't know. It's
I kind of always have liked it as an interesting. It's different, but
I think it's cool. Yeah. I do like it. The action with him is good.
Of course, all I can ever think of when I see that first fight between them, where Peter's out of costume and everything, and they're fighting in the midair, is the Spider-Man 3 video game, which that was the most annoying boss, where you have to, like, time button presses and stuff. It was an annoying boss, and that's all I can think of
watching this game. The game was a button masher anyway, but then that one was, like, a timed button masher.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. But what do you think of Harry and sort of the new Goblin arc?
I think it's fine. Like, it's hard for me to just, like, because this is, like, how I feel about the movies. Like, they should have done one of two movies. Either you do Spider-Man with the black suit and then Venom, or you do Spider-Man and versus, like, Sandman and the New Goblin. Like, they could have done New Goblin and Sandman together, could have worked. It's like, with Venom in there. And I think that the New Goblin and the Sandman stuff would have worked the best if they had been able to, like, make a whole movie just about that.
But I do kind of think, in a certain sense, I see where the black suit Spider-Man fits into those stories with New Goblin and Sandman.
Yeah.
And it's about Peter's rage and sense of revenge and him learning again another part of him being a hero. And I do like, it's way underdeveloped and they needed to do a lot more with it, but I do like the scene where he goes and, you know, brutally hurts Harry and disfigures him. And then Harry, you know, he has to deal with what he did to his best friend. Of course, he doesn't have to deal with it because they don't write that into the movie.
Yeah.
But it's a good, in theory, it's a good idea. And it's in theory a good idea that he tries to kill Sandman because he, you know, killed his uncle. But it's not handled well. And I see exactly what you mean where they're not melding it well. It feels like two movies. It, you know, Disco Pete.
Yeah, it's like all that stuff like is from like a completely different movie.
Yeah, and so that's New Goblin. Sandman, I will say this. Visually, I cannot imagine a better live-action representation of Sandman. They perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Those special effects are amazing.
Yeah, especially, I really love the whole scene where he's trying to reconstruct himself after he falls into the pit that turns him into Sandman.
Really good stuff there. And again, he needed his own movie or his own co-movie sort of to establish the emotional arc he went through. Like, yeah. I like that they change it. In the comics, he's just Flint Marko, petty criminal.
Yeah.
Here he's a real character.
Yeah, he's got the whole thing with his daughter that he's trying to take care of.
Like, which could have been really compelling.
There's not enough time.
Anything into
it. It's like one scene.
Yeah, and Thomas Hayden Church clearly could have been as good as Alfred Molina. Or
he was a really good Sandman. Yeah. I liked the structure of Sandman, like all the stuff, like all the potential Sandman could have had.
Yeah.
Like all the framework of it was done well, and then but all the use of him in the actual story was really poor.
Yeah. And he sells some good scenes. Like, one of the scenes I really love in the movie is at the very end when Peter forgives himself and forgives Sandman. And Thomas Hayden Church is good in that. Of course, they don't earn that scene because there's hardly any time with Sandman in the movie. But it's still interesting. And I do like the black suit fight with Sandman, which is, I think, the only time he actually wears the black suit in the friggin' movie. I think the only other time is when he's taking it off, but whatever. It's still a cool fight.
Yeah.
And brutal. And you haven't seen Spider-Man do that before. But again, those are isolated moments in a story that doesn't work. And then you've got all the... those are all the big characters, right?
Yeah.
Then you've got the peripheral characters.
Well, wait, we didn't do Eddie.
That's a peripheral character to me because important in the last 30 minutes.
He should be a big character.
Yes. So let's talk about Eddie Brock. I don't have anything against Topher Grace. He's a fine actor, whatever.
Yeah.
Fuck him in this movie. It's
just like it really miscast. Like it's just like
Well, and they gave
and everything with
all
the stuff with Venom and Eddie Brock isn't done well. So it's not just like Topher Grace. Like
nobody
could have worked with that.
I don't blame Topher Grace for it. He didn't necessarily do anything wrong. He was tasked with being this asshole, petty person.
That's the thing I really like. Even all the other villains, there's something about them that could really work and make them compelling. In this incarnation of Eddie Brock, there's nothing about him
that
makes him likable or compelling or good as a villain.
Or sympathetic.
Or good as a person. Yeah.
Like, they try to make it at the end to show, like, oh, Peter did something terrible to him. Like, he did it to the others. No, he didn't.
This is like...
Yeah.
There's, like, he, like, broke his camera. It's like, oh, boo-hoo.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thing they're referring to is that he got the job at the Bugle for taking a picture of Spider-Man that he faked. So then Peter...
Exposes
him. In his, like, symbiote, angry
Peter, Disco Pete.
He exposes him for that. But even, like, if he hadn't been the symbiote guy, he probably still would have done that, because that would be the right thing to do.
Yeah,
right.
He was...
Eddie broke the law.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eddie defamed someone.
And then he tries to kill him for it. He even prays. He's like, God, please kill Peter Parker.
It's so weird.
It's like, dude.
Yeah. It's like, all the Eddie Brock stuff just doesn't...
It's terrible. Doesn't
I mean, yeah, if they were going to... The problem is, if they were going to do Venom... They like the only way to do that. You would have had to have had Eddie Brock
in movie one.
Yeah, at least like as a peripheral character and give him a little bit of stuff.
Yeah,
and like set him up a little bit. But it's like almost like kind of like the same as like Kirk Connors. So like he has a little bit of a role. And if they had done Lizard, they could have.
Well,
used
to be honest, it would basically be how they used Harry in films one and two.
Yeah, the same thing.
Yeah. And so I hate every bit of the Eddie Brock Venom stuff. It's awful. I do get a big kick out of the scene, though, where when Disco Pete goes to the Daily Bugle and punches Eddie and, like, makes him lose his job because it's so over the top and Eddie's finally getting his comeuppance. That's fun.
Yeah.
But not in the way it's supposed to be. Okay, other peripheral characters. We have Captain Stacy, played by James Cromwell, which is cool casting, but he gets nothing to do.
I didn't even remember Captain Stacy was in the movie.
Yeah, he's in like two scenes.
Yeah.
And it's James Cromwell, who's awesome. And talk about underusing a legendary actor. I mean,
in the first scene he's in, he's looking up, his daughter is about to die.
Yeah, he's like,
and he's not reacting.
Yeah, it's great. And then we have fake Gwen Stacy. And fuck fake Gwen Stacy, because she is the most annoying character in any of these movies, and the most infuriating, because you can read the character in one of two ways. The first way is Sam Raimi hates Gwen in the comics and just wants to parody her mercilessly, and in that case, it's a little funny. And then the other one is where they had never read a comic with Gwen Stacy.
Yeah,
and
I don't understand why they decided. It's like there's no reason to put Gwen Stacy in the movie. Like there's no, you don't need to do Gwen Stacy.
But they didn't do Gwen Stacy. They did fake.
That's what I'm saying. It's like you didn't need to name her. Like just call her Liz Allen. That's another like small female side character.
Yeah.
It's like you could do that. It's like you could do. I mean, fuck. You could have done Felicia Hardy in Black Cat. I mean, you would have thrown another superhero character into the mix, but it would have made more frickin' sense. I mean, that's how Black Cat works in the comics. Yes. Black Cat is the one who... Black Cat's the only character who has ever been able to realistically sort of disrupt Peter's relationship with Mary Jane.
Yeah.
Because Black Cat connects with Peter as Spider-Man.
And I actually think Bryce Dallas Howard would have been interesting as that.
Yeah, it's like they... I really like Black Cat as a character. It's like, yeah, they could have done that. Nope, they decided, oh, let's... Let's take Gwen, let's take the character name Gwen Stacy, and get a blonde woman and name her Gwen Stacy, and then
this is an alternate.
Let's just throw that in there.
This is where like Gwen Stacy's mother was like abused and like drinking and doing drugs when she was pregnant and born like this Gwen Stacy, who's a fucking idiot and just is stupid beyond belief and petty. And, like, doesn't understand how the world works in any sense, and she's a model for some reason, because if there was any defining characteristic of Gwen in every other incarnation of Spider-Man, it's that she's a beautiful model, I guess.
Yeah, like, how, wait, Mary Jane! Mary Jane is a model!
There you go!
Oh, well, there we go! So I guess they kind of took that for, like, they kind of actually did make Gwen Stacy more like Mary Jane in the comic books.
Yes.
It's really weird.
But like, Mary Jane never that stupid?
Yeah. No, Mary Jane was never stupid at all.
She's just Gwen Stacy in this movie is a dumb blonde. And like, that's all there is.
So there's the infamous scene where Disco Peter goes to the club and does the jazz dance. Why do you call him
Disco Peter? He's not Disco. Yeah, but he's Emo Peter. He's not wearing, like, parachute pants and, like, a silver shirt.
It's funny to me to call him Disco Pete, because Emo Pete makes me want to punch whoever says it, because I don't know. It makes me...
But that's what he is.
But he's not really going around brooding and being emo. He's going around dancing.
Yeah, because emo people don't go around brooding being emo. It's all fake and a facade. That's why it's funny and it's really appropriate.
Okay. Anyway, so Pete, you know, like the scene where there's at the jazz club, and then at the very end, Bryce Dallas Howard, you know, fake Gwen, yeah, Jazz Pete, and fake Gwen says, I don't think you actually like me, or something like that. It's like, no shit! You're the stupidest person on Earth! I hate fake Gwen Stacy! She pisses me off so much! And it's just like, they spend so much time on her! She's in the periphery, but she's in, like, every other goddamn scene! And for some reason, Peter can't resist her, and I don't... You know, why can't they just have, you know, he takes her off, he fucks her, leave her alone, and then never come back to it, and they don't have to reference it again. He had a weak moment, he cheated on Mary Jane... Get that out of the picture if that's what you want to do.
That's not going in a Spider-Man movie.
Well, that should have
been. If it was Black Cat, it could have worked.
Well, that should have
been. But then you would have had three movies in one movie instead of just two.
I know.
This is like, yeah.
I hate fake Gwen. Sorry. I think I just have on my notes somewhere in big letters, go away. Go away, fake Gwen. That's in the scene where...
Just said, go away, fuck Gwen.
Yes, that's the scene that pisses me off, where he's proposing and Gwen is there and she comes in and is talking to him. It's like, hi, Pete! And he can't... He's about to propose to Mary Jane and he can't ignore Gwen Stacy or fake Gwen Stacy for like 10 fucking seconds. God.
Yeah.
Stupid movie. And then it all culminates, so Eddie Brock becomes Venom and...
Well, I mean, he becomes really something. He whatever fuck that
it's
was.
It's not Eddie Brock and it's not Venom. So. Yeah.
It's something.
Well, okay, we've been ignoring the elephant in the room. We've mentioned it here and there. What do you feel about how they actually do the symbiote story once Peter gets the symbiote?
It's not good. Like they don't do that story well at all.
No, because it's like 20 minutes of the movie from when he gets the suit to when he gets rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
It is like 20 minutes, and it's just him dancing. And here's the thing, though. Those 20 minutes are my favorite 20 minutes of the movie. I have no qualms about saying that because they are, at the very least, lively and interesting, and they're an interesting interpretation of that. Like, I actually think there's potential there with... Like, people get hung up on the dancing stuff. I don't care about that. It's actually kind of a funny moment. I always laugh at it. I think it's fine. But the point there is that he's hurting the people around him. I like that. If you had... simultaneously done
you like
that.
Hurting the people around you? What?
No. I like that they explore that, though. The symbiote makes him a jerk to the people he loves. And what they needed to do, of course, is they never show how that affects the Spider-Man persona, though.
Mm-hmm.
Except, you know, he goes and punches Sandman and, you know, stuff. But then you never see him being Black Suit Spider-Man again. So they only show sort of this one little side of this, what the symbiote does to him. And it's all, obviously, it's based around dancing and jazz and stuff. But I like that part of it, and it just needs a lot more around it to flesh that out. Like, as you said, you know, if they did a movie just about the symbiote, if that jazz club scene were in that movie, people, I don't think, would complain about it, because it would feel at home with that.
I mean, Although it's like the jazz, like the whole jazz club scene is like really ridiculous.
Yeah, but yeah, and I like it because it's bad and I laugh at it. But you know, it's more interesting to me than a lot of the other things they fuck up in this movie.
Yeah.
And then he decides, and then they don't even really build to a moment where he needs to get rid of it. It's just, he was mean to Mary Jane and he hit her, which is bad, is very, very bad.
Uh-huh.
But, like, yeah. Is it really enough for him to go through this giant moral, like, religious crisis where he goes to the church and he's ripping it off? And, you know, it's just, it doesn't hit home.
It's like, I really should have rewatched this movie because it's like, I'm trying to figure out which versions of the story in my mind were the original, the Spider-Man 3 or the Ultimate Spider-Man version of the story. It's like, does he ever go to Kurt Connors in this movie with the symbiote?
Yeah, but it's like a one-minute scene. And
it's Kurt, like Kurt calls him
and
tells him that it has the characteristics of an aggressive symbiote, and that's the whole thing.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, it's just like, they didn't... Because they just didn't, they just didn't do that. Like, that story needed to breathe a lot more to do it properly, because it's got... they kind of go through, like, the basic steps of it, but not...
Here's my comparison is...
All the way through.
So Sean and Thomas and I all love the Spectacular Spider-Man animated series from a couple of years back.
Mm-hmm.
Really great interpretation of the character. And the last arc of the series is the symbiote. Really good.
I haven't gotten that far.
Oh, you haven't?
I've never actually got to the very end of season one.
Oh, okay. But it's a really great... They do it really well... And it's like four episodes, and it starts to show how it affects his personal life and his Spider-Man persona, and it gets to a point where he has no other choice but get rid of it. And they do it really well. And it's very much a character examination, and that's what I feel the symbiote should be used for, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's like, it does show, because they, like I said, they do some of the steps in it where it's like, it enhances Peter's powers, it makes him more aggressive, it makes him stronger, I mean, in this, it doesn't have to deal with the web shooter thing, but in the comic books, now he doesn't have to use web shooters. It can transform into his normal day clothes.
Yeah.
It's like, it's super useful. I mean, he got it, like, on an alien planet during Secret Wars. They should have done that in this. They should have, like, thrown, like, the entire, like 10-issue miniseries of Secret Wars and thrown the comic books, and just did that in, like, 10 minutes at the beginning of the movie with, like, Captain America and She-Hulk and Iron Man and, like, all the characters from the miniseries of the comic books, and that's the origin of the suit. But yeah, it's like, and he's very enthusiastic, he's very happy, because it's like, oh, I've got all these tools now to actually, you know, fight crime and be what I need to be, and I'm a lot better at what I'm doing, but it starts feeding off of his emotions. It does, I do really love they do the thing where it takes him out, like, the suit controls him while he's asleep, and goes out and does what it wants to do.
Yeah.
And the whole thing with, like, the suit starts feeding off of his emotions and feeding off of who he is. And it's like, it brings out the darker side of Peter, and Peter needs to realize that even though he's fighting crime, that he can't, there's a line that he can't cross.
Yeah.
And he needs to stay who he is.
Yeah.
And not sacrifice his ideals for more power.
Right. But anyway, that all leads. He gets rid of the suit. It goes to fake Eddie Brock, who becomes fake Venom, who makes some allegiance with Sandman that I don't quite understand. And then they kidnap Mary Jane. What a fucking incredible plan. But wait, how do they know? So Eddie Brock somehow figured out Pete was
Eddie
Spider-Man.
Brock, here's how it happens in the movie.
Well, he's got the symbiote. Like, Venom knows that Peter Parker is Spider-Man.
They don't do that in the movie, though.
Yeah, they don't say the symbiote gives any information, though.
But
they don't suggest that.
But
it talks.
He becomes one entity with the symbiote. He becomes Venom.
Yeah, but
I mean,
in the movies,
I don't remember like if they
in
ever
the movie
have a
specifically what happens when they find out who he is he's looking up at the bell tower when Peter Parker takes off the symbiote suit, and somehow from like 50 stories down, he can see that it's Parker.
Yeah,
and he says that. And then he's Venom.
Okay.
Like, Parker? And that's it.
I kind of remember
super,
that. Now,
it's super stupid. And then they move on.
Stupid.
Yep.
Stupid.
And then, of course, so they do all that. They're at the big construction place. Harry gets into the fray.
It's a good action scene.
Yeah, to the movies, it's a fairly good one. I don't quite like how it wraps up.
It's not as good as, like, the Doc Ock scene.
No. Because they do a good job at initially for first couple minutes at showing this four-way action scene.
Yeah.
But then they just sort of break it all up and everyone's fighting individually and it's not as interesting, you know. It's sort of like what the Avengers, they're trying to do what the Avengers does, but not well, you know, with a lot of different moving pieces.
Also, it's just, since they had never established, Venom hadn't been in a fight up to that point, they hadn't established Venom as a villain in a fight, because that's how you structure, like, every superhero movie. You have a small fight, like the bank scene with Doc Ock, or the the Unity Day or whatever with Green Goblin, and sort of establish what their powers and like give a little bit of a fight so you get a perspective for the final fight. They did that with Sandman in Spider-Man 3 and New Goblin. But it's like, not with Venom. And so it's like, in the big culminating scene is his fight scene with Venom, and he figures out like how you can use sound to defeat the symbiote. But it's like, like you don't have any perspective for that fight because you didn't have another fight with Venom.
And then Harry dies, and it's suitably emotional, I guess, but not as much as it could be if this was a movie more focused on Harry, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or if the trilogy had done a better job with Harry overall. And then you have, you know, and here's what I like. This movie does at least sufficiently wrap up Peter's emotional arc through the three movies with Sandman, where he learns to forgive Sandman and himself by extension, and he has that speech. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, does feel like a good place to close the trilogy, in a sense, because it's Peter working through one of the last sort of emotional issues he has from the very beginning of movie one. So I can give that, but again, that could have been much more powerful. And then the last scene is he goes back and sort of reunites with Mary Jane, which is a fine place to end things, I guess, but again, not nearly as satisfying as where Spider-Man 2 ends. So it's such a profoundly disappointing movie to me, especially when you watch it in close proximity to 1 and 2, which are so good and flow so well into one another. Mm-hmm. And then 3 is just a mess. And I don't know. I still don't hate it, but I really don't like it at this point. And I don't know if I ever, again, I don't know if I ever want to watch it again.
I'm in exactly the same boat. And it's like, the thing is, I really love the symbiote storyline in the comic books. Is a really well done storyline. I mean, even though, it's kind of cheesy because of the comic book stuff, but it's one of those few stories, kind of like with the death of Gwen Stacy, that it's like that transcends sort of the cheesiness of it just being a comic book and is just a really, really well done story in its original form, and they didn't do it well. And I also just don't like, I mean, we talked about this a little bit, but I always am just like disappointed that they didn't like the redesign of the black suit, because the original design of the black suit is like the coolest costume design ever. It is so perfect in how it's all black, but he's got the big white sort of like all like spider symbol that goes across his chest, and then like the two white things on his gloves that shoot the web out. And it's like, it's such a simplistic, minimalistic, perfect design for costume, and it's so cool. And they would pull it out every now and then after the symbiote thing just because it was such a cool costume design. And then Venom was basically that, only with he was really, really, really freaking huge, and he had like fangs and the big eyes.
Yeah.
Like it had kind of like almost like tapered off like flames. It's like, it's such a perfect costume design, and it didn't like, they didn't capture that, because it didn't have that element of the big white symbol that sort of broke up the black and made it look really dynamic. Yeah. And then also, like, and then Venom had the same thing where it's like he was just black, like it was the big black hulking thing, and he wasn't even that, he wasn't like huge. Like Venom is, like I said, he's like 7 feet tall and like built out of muscle, because that's how Eddie Brock is.
And the fights with him should be brutal and just hurt to watch.
Yeah, you know? And they just didn't do Venom at all. Like, they didn't capture anything of Venom's character, as far as I could tell from the movie. I mean, it's been a really long time since I actually watched it.
No, they don't. It's, he's,
yeah, it's like,
the thing they keep doing,
because he's barely even in the movie when he actually becomes Venom.
Yeah.
The thing they actually, that I really pisses me off, that, like, I mean, the suit thing doesn't, like, hurt the quality of the movie, really, I guess. But what?
Yeah, but it was just what it's just right. Like a little like nitpick.
That's, right. But here's something cool that I think is more than a nitpick, is whenever they have the suit, like the helmet or the face part, come back and show Eddie, it's a terrible effect. It's like, for it looks like his head has been photoshopped onto CGI, and he's got like fangs that look awful, and there's like black stuff in them, and he's talking.
Yeah, because Eddie Brock doesn't have fangs. It's like, it's only when the Venom suit is overhead does he have the fangs. And I don't know how that's supposed to work.
They look like Halloween fangs he's put in, and he has a lisp for some reason. Like, he can't talk through those prosthetics. It's terrible.
And it's just like, and they didn't do any of the stuff with like Venom. Like, Venom never talks, like, he never says this, like, refers to himself as we, right? In the movie? I don't remember.
Think so,
like,
no.
He doesn't in the movie.
Yeah, it's like, there's always this big sense that Venom, like, that the symbiote has really attached to Eddie Brock, and it's like, they are basically one entity. It's like, and they never did this thing where it's like, Venom has his own, like, code of honor, like his own, like Venom thinks that he's a hero, thinks he's trying to, like, he's doing the right thing, and he's basically like Spider-Man, only he kills people. Like, he still sometimes fights crime. He just kills the people that are committing the crimes, and he thinks he's doing the right thing. Hmm. It's like, and Venom's a really interesting character, if you do him well, and you do him as he's done in the good Venom comic books. Like, he can be, he some kind of turned into a very stale character because he became really overused and kind of cliched in Spider-Man comic books. But, like, as he originally was formed, and then a lot of really good Venom comics, he's a really interesting character. Like, in Maximum Carnage, where Spider-Man and Venom have to team together to fight Carnage. Yeah. It's a really interesting dynamic between Spider-Man and Venom, because the symbiote wants to attach to Spider-Man. It wants to be a part of Peter, because Peter's more powerful naturally than Eddie. It's like, they don't capture any of that dynamic at all in the movie.
Yeah.
It's just nothing of the interesting part of Venom is in the movie, when they tried to do Venom, and it's really...
Yeah, disappointing. It brings down the movie a lot. And I, again, my other big problem, which I hinted at earlier, is I don't like where the movie starts. I don't like that it starts with Peter has somehow found perfect life balance because he's with Mary Jane. That's less compelling to me. And that he only has problems because he and Mary Jane stopped communicating because the screenwriters decided they would stop communicating. It doesn't work. It's like, Peter has to be undergoing some kind of hardship for this to be compelling, and he's really not in this movie. He just keeps fucking up because he's doing dumb things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not a good movie.
I agree.
Yeah. Anything else to say about Spider-Man?
Even though we've been ranting about it, I still feel it's not as bad as most people make it out to be.
No, it's not.
But it's like, the thing is that it has so much wasted potential. And it makes just like a few really critical missteps that like, caused the movie to fall apart.
And I hope we weren't too harsh, because I think we pointed out what we liked about it. Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst are still good. Thomas Hayden Church is very good.
The action's still good.
Yeah.
The effects on Sandman are awesome.
Amazing. Good cinematography. I don't like the music. They replaced Danny Elfman in this with Christopher Young, who I only know his work because I, you know, review movies and go to see a lot of movies, and he mostly does sort of, like, cut-rate romantic comedies and, like, really, like, low-budget stuff. He's not a good composer. He's not the composer you get for your big summer tentpole. And it's the most bland, generic, and sometimes completely ill-fitting music. Like, in the scene where Peter goes to fight Harry, and it's just they're one-on-one, they don't have their costumes or anything. It's actually kind of a good fight scene and kind of interesting and brutal. It's like this weird jazz thing. She's like, dum ba dum ba dum ba dum ba dum ba dum in the background. It's like,
I remember that now.
It's so, it's like what you would do on YouTube, like as a music video to make fun of the scene. It's terrible. Yeah. Music's not good in this one.
It's like the music is all filler that was done by a 4-year-old.
I don't know if that's that
they're going to replace with like, the actual soundtrack.
I hate the score.
Okay.
In this movie.
Okay.
It's awful. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm not going to say anything.
That's fine. But I mean, the Danny Elfman when the Danny Elfman themes recur, they're cool.
They're cool, and then he ruins them he keeps writing music, and it's horrible. Yeah. Like if they had just taken the score from the first two movies and somehow just sort of redone it for the score for the third movie, I think that would have been better. Harry Potter 2 is pretty much the score for Harry Potter 1, and it works somehow.
It works. I wish. Sam Raimi and Danny Elfman could have kind of, you know, grown up and gotten past their issues and done the movie together, because he's scoring the movie. He's not acting in the movie. They don't even have to talk to each other if they don't want. Anyway, but that's Spider-Man 3. Overall thoughts on the Spider-Man trilogy, Sean?
Overall, even though we ended with the bad one, because it ended with the bad one, I still really love the Spider-Man movies. The first and the second one are great. I watch them all the time. Spider-Man 2 is one of my favorite movies. It's my favorite superhero movie. And I think those movies really captured Spider-Man as a character, or at least how I view Spider-Man. That's the kind of Spider-Man that I like a lot. So
I totally agree with Sean.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot to admire here. I still think it's one of the most significant blockbuster trilogies in terms of film history. It's going to go down as something that really influenced how we view not just superhero movies, but sort of the blockbuster, in that it's not about action. It's about grounding it in human drama that we can relate to and that means something. And I think, you know, even though Spider-Man 3 didn't do it well, they still were trying that. And that's significant to note, is that these movies did establish, I don't know if formula is the right word, but a sort of a trick to make these movies work. And to make comic book movies, which are, you know, comic books are episodic, movies are big and, you know, sweeping, and they have, you have to have a sustained story.
Yeah.
And they did that well. And they, you know, these are important movies. Thomas?
What's
your thoughts on the trilogy?
They're good movies, the first two. I like watching them.
Okay.
So, are you going to finish, or is that...
That was a complete sentence.
So yeah, you ended it with, like, I like watching them, and then it sounded like you're going to go...
Well, maybe I was going to say something else, but, you know, you'll never know now.
I'm sure it would have been a very enlightening thought.
It would have been the most enlightening thing.
Yeah, okay.
Humanity is poor for you having not said your finish your thought.
Yes. All the people that listen to this, your lives are ruined.
So
would have been so enriched.
So let's talk about, really quickly, Amazing Spider-Man is coming out.
Amazing Spider-Man!
I'm excited for this movie. Are you excited for it at all, Sean?
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm not as excited as most people, just because I still think it's... Even though it's actually been a while since the Spider-Man movies came out, it's not long enough, and I don't like the reboot. But, I mean, I'm still looking forward to it. I'm not, like, going to go into the movie and hate it just because I don't want to like it.
Yeah.
It's like, I want the movie to be good, but I'm not, like, hugely excited for it.
Well, and Sean, you and I have talked about how neither of us have been that sold by the marketing.
Yeah, it's
but
not
that,
really compelling to me.
We also agreed, though, that it seems much more like just... This is manipulative marketing. It doesn't seem like it's representative of what the movie's going to be.
Yeah.
And now that some early reviews have come in, that seems to be true. You know, people have said it's very fun and it's got a lot of really great elements. And Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone are great. And I do like a lot of the direction of it. The one thing that gives me pause, and I know it's the exact same thing that gives you pause, is the focus on not the nitpick me pause. The actual substantial.
I thought you
thing.
Had finally come over
no.
to my side and seen.
The no, light. I agree. The suit does not look as good as. Well, okay. I'm going to get to my substantial complaint in a second. Let's let Sean do his stupid fucking nitpick for a second.
But it's not just a stupid fuck. It's kind of the same with, like, Venom. It's like, you've got one of the best designs of all time for a costume. I mean, seriously, the Spider-Man is the original costume, completely classic. Steve Ditko, brilliant in creating that costume. It's one of the few superhero costumes that just completely covers the entire body. It's perfect. It's a the color balance, everything about it is perfect. Then come Amazing Spider-Man, they all of a sudden they decide that, well, okay, I mean, the color balance between the red and the blue on the original costume was absolutely perfect, but you know what we could do? Let's just put blue all over the fucking place, including his fucking fingertips. Before, Spider-Man's gloves were solid red with, like, the web pattern. Now they've, like, the blue, like, creeps up into the red and goes around to the fingertips, and it just ruins the color balance. It's really awkward. It's like, and the whole thing, it looks more like they, I mean, they fucked with the Spider-Man symbol where it's, like, much larger and it sort of, like, creeps, like, it's got a lot longer legs, especially on the back end. It's just, the blues, it just has too much blue. There's no reason.
I agree it has too much blue.
Oh, and also I don't like that the, like, eyepieces are really, like, a sort of orange.
Yeah, I don't think
orange.
I kind of wish they would have kept...
Yeah, but at least in the trailers, it definitely looked like...
Yeah, no, they are.
Like oranges.
Yeah.
I kind of wish they had kept the costume mostly the same from the Raimi movies, because the Raimi movies just did the Ditko costume, right?
Yeah, I mean, basically, the only thing they did is that they made it almost sort of, they, like, added that texture to it almost like Kevlar-y instead of it just
right.
being, like,
I think they
kind of
had to do that.
Yeah, because you can't just, like, in comic books, you can just have it be, like, cloth. Like, Batman's costume is just cloth in the comic books. Superman is just, like, cloth. But you can't really do it. It would sag and it wouldn't look good.
I like the material they have for the new costume, and if they did that with the original color scheme, I think it would be a very sharp take on it.
Yeah. It's just like they just tried to do too much where it's like it's sort of like the blue flows around instead of there being like solid sections, and I just don't.
No.
It just doesn't look right.
I'm wondering if that was in part just to distinguish it more from the old movies. Though.
Well, and I get why they wanted
God,
to do that,
like,
but you could do it in other
like,
ways.
Yeah, the whole, like, inner piece of the glove is all blue.
Well, here's a good question,
Sean. They
ruined
the movie with that.
Sean, do you agree that they probably should redesign it a little bit to distinguish, but
I mean,
not...
yeah, I mean, it would inevitably, just because you're making a different costume, looks like it'd be a different size. I mean, there needs to be a little, like, you could mess with, like, how a little bit of how, like, the spider symbol looks and stuff like that, but, like, changing the color balance of it like that makes it seem weird, because it kind of looks like in the Clone Saga, there was a Spider-Man clone who was maybe a clone, who was not a clone, then was a clone again, and then Gwen Stacy was a clone, and then there are thousands of clones, and everyone is a clone, and then Marvel realizes that was a stupid story arc for 10 years and decided not to do that. That's another rant, the Clone Saga, but there's a character, Ben Reilly, who was the Spider-Man clone, one of the Spider-Man clones. He who became a... He's still, I think, a major character in the Marvel Universe. He died. When you say a character in comic books died, it's like, do you mean he died for an issue? I mean, Spider-Man's died twice, I'm pretty sure. I know he's at least died once. I've read one where he's died. I'm pretty sure he's died another time. Okay. Counting all the clones, he's probably died thousands of times. But Ben Reilly, he adopted his own superhero moniker called the Scarlet Spider that was mostly blue, and it looks like they mixed the Scarlet Spider costume with the normal Spider-Man costume, and it just looks funky to me.
Yeah.
It's like, I get it's nitpick, but it's like, they just fucked it up, and there's no reason to fuck it up. It's like with the symbiote costume. It's like, you got the perfect design. There's no reason to fuck with it. It's like in DC Comics, they just recently with Nightwing, who had also a perfect costume design with the balance of blue and black was perfect, and then they made the blue red in Nightwing's costumes. People are fucked with all the costumes.
That just makes him look like Robin, wouldn't it?
It's like black with like a red strip on the front. It's like, it's just like ruins. They just keep on fucking with all the costumes. I mean, all the New 52, they got rid of Superman's trunks, and they made this belt red, which I think actually kind of works. It's like, they got rid of all the superheroes' trunks, basically. It's like, it's just like, everyone's fucking with the costumes, and I don't think they need to.
I gotcha.
Especially the blue fingertips. It's fucked up.
Now, can I do my actual substantive narrative complaint?
The blue fingertips, it disrupts the narrative.
You haven't seen the movie
yet. It's like he's a completely different character. The Peter Parker I know would not have made the decision to put blue fingertips on his costume, because he would have known that was stupid. It ruins the character development.
Okay. Now, again, we're all saying this before we've seen the movie or any of this in context, but from what I've seen so far, I mean, obviously there's a focus in this movie on Peter being a little angsty about not knowing his parents and his parents being gone.
Yeah, I don't like that direction that much. And, I mean, it could work well.
It could work great, because I've heard Mark Webb, the director, Mark Webb's a great director, I'm excited to see him do this. I've heard him talk about this, and I like the thematic thing he's trying to say, which is that, especially how he's tying it with Lizard, where Peter feels he's got a piece missing. Lizard has a piece missing, or Kurt Connors does with his arm, and they're both sort of trying to fill it, and that's what contrasts them, the ways they do it. That could be a really interesting thematic direction to go in. And they would distinguish it, I think, from the earlier movies. And I do think you need to do something to distinguish it.
Yeah.
And if the parents thing is not the whole movie, like, it's not like Peter just forgets about his aunt and uncle because he's so... They still need to just define that relationship.
Yeah.
And if they can do that and have him be a little angsty about it, I'm fine with that. But the thing there is that I think you do have to keep the focus on Aunt May and Uncle Ben because they are so important to him.
Yeah.
And I don't want them to try to make it like these people don't fulfill his parental needs, because they do. And
that's one of the weird things. That's one of the things I've always found interesting about the old Spider-Man stories, is that he's living with his uncle and his aunt, but they never brings up the fact that his parents aren't there. Like, that's not really an issue. And it's just like this little kind of interesting thing that you don't really know about. And then you find out that they were S.H.I.E.L.D. agents, and then they got killed in a plane crash, but then they weren't really, and then they were clones, and they were robots and comic books.
Yeah.
Huh. Hopefully they turn it. Hopefully the backstory in Amazing Spider-Man is that his parents were secret agents. I hope that happens, because...
Would you be happy with that?
I would be happy in that that was a stupid thing to take from the comic book sort of way. Okay. I've never liked what they did with Peter's parents in the comic books. I never thought it was necessary to bring them back. Like, they did interesting stuff in Ultimate Spider-Man, where he has this sort of, because his father was a scientist in, I don't know if he was a scientist in the main Marvel universe. Well, no, he was a secret agent, and so was his wife. But yeah, Richard Parker was a scientist in Ultimate Spider-Man, and that's kind of what piques Peter's interest into it. And like, there's this whole relationship that he has through the Venom arc in Ultimate Spider-Man that's really well done. So they handle it kind of like that, where it's like, it's not like, it's like this small driving force. It's not like this big, it's like, oh, my life is ruined because I don't know my parents. But it's like, you know, I wish I knew who they were. And he's got like this sort of like subtle melancholy sometimes. Like in the comic, in Ultimate Spider-Man, he finds this videotape of his parents and uncle, his uncle and his aunt and him on like this family picnic. And he's like, is watching the videotape and has this conversation with his aunt. And it's really nice and thoughtful. And it's like, it's not like, life has been ruined.
And I'm guessing that's where they're going to go with it, just personally. And if they do, I would actually really like that, I think.
Yeah.
But, and to be fair, all the, like, I've had to report so much for We Got This Covered on fucking Amazing Spider-Man trailers. Stop marketing your movie. I get, you have enough trailers. Stop it. For the love of God,
I haven't watched, like, the last one or two that have come out
because I have to put up
any more trailers.
If I have to put up one more fucking TV spot, I'm going to go insane. There's too many of them. I've stopped watching them. When I report on these, I don't want to know anymore. I'm the critic. I have to review the movie. I don't want to see it all before I see the movie. My point is, they did one, they did a 6-minute clip reel, and they showed it before Men in Black 3. And I went to see Men in Black 3 mostly actually just to see that clip reel because it sounded really interesting. And that is much better than any of the trailers. Like, because it's just clips, it's scenes in context, and it plays really well. And everything that's sort of overplayed in the trailers is played really naturally in those scenes. Like, there's a really good scene where it's Peter talking to Uncle Ben, and I guess Peter, like, lashed out at a bully, and Uncle Ben, who's played by Martin Sheen.
Flash Thompson.
Yeah, it's Uncle Ben is played by Martin Sheen, which I think is really cool, because I love Martin Sheen. And he's trying to talk to, you know, Peter. It's sort of like the Great Responsibility scene, but not quite. But it's a really nice scene. There's some other good ones, like with Kurt Connors that I saw. And I really like all that stuff, and it indicates more of what I think the movie's actually going to be. And if the movie is like what I saw in those 6 minutes, it'll be a great movie. That was a great clip package. I actually really liked Men in Black 3. It was better than, like, the movie I saw after it. But anyway. So I am excited for the movie. I'm eager to see it. It's actually one of the few times where I'm interested to see what the director does with 3D. Because I think, like, you could... It was shot in 3D and everything was planned for it. So it could work. And I think Spider-Man in action, that could be a good visual way to distinguish it from what Raimi did.
When you get webbed in the face.
Exactly. But...
No, like, that would be...
If it was silly string thrown at the
audience. Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because they did that with, like, a lot of horror movies in, like, the 70s, where they would, like, put, like people dress as skeletons at the theaters and stuff like that. That would be awesome. This is, like, he shoots web at the screen, and then, like, silly string shoots out at the audience.
That's how they end the movie. He, like, aims at the camera, just goes, whoosh, and it goes...
Flip.
Yeah, flip. All right, so we will be talking more about The Amazing Spider-Man 2 weeks from today in podcast number 5. It will be coming out July 11th. That's when Sean and me and maybe Thomas, hopefully, we'll all have seen The Amazing Spider-Man by then, and hopefully you will. And on podcast number 5, 2 weeks from today, we're going to do an in-depth, spoilery discussion. We're going to talk about the whole movie, what we thought of it, what we think could have been done better, what was done really well, all those sorts of things. Don't listen to that podcast until you've seen The Amazing Spider-Man. And on next week's show, number 4, we will be doing another sort of spoiler cast. This one will be for the movie Prometheus, which Sean and I have a lot to say. We've actually already recorded the discussion. It's about 2 hours long, really in-depth on Prometheus and the problems we had with it and the things we liked about it. So if you enjoyed Prometheus or if you didn't enjoy Prometheus, come listen to our discussion. We go into every single nitpicky detail on it we can possibly imagine. That will be podcast number 4 coming out next week on July 4th. And remember, on July 11th, we will have our in-depth spoiler discussion of The Amazing Spider-Man. So for the next 2 weeks, we'll be talking about in-depth about movies. So, with that being said, it's time to end the podcast. I'm Jonathan.
I'm Sean.
I was Thomas.
And I'm Spider-Man.